award-winning Night Call, the Riff's phone-in talk show on 101 WRIF Detroit. Our number, 313-298-WRIF. Now, here's the host of Night Call, Peter Werby.
Welcome to the broadcast. Thanks for being with us. Okay, and if I push that one down, every once in a while I forget how to operate this. There we go. How you doing tonight? Thanks for joining me here from the WRIF in Detroit. I have to say that because we have listeners all around the country, all around the world via the internet. Primarily, though, we're broadcasting into the Detroit area, southern Ontario, northern Ohio. But with the World Wide Web, wow, we are bad. We are nationwide. That's the old ZZ Top 10. Oh, yeah, we're international. I guess that doesn't rhyme, does it? Anyways, the Oscar is about winding up. Reese Witherspoon just won Best Actress for Walk the Line, the Johnny Cash biopic, which is one of the few. Oh, yeah, I saw a couple of the ones that were nominated for Best Picture. Crash didn't see, Brokeback Mountain didn't see, Capote I didn't see. I saw Goodnight and Good Luck, and I didn't see Munich. So I saw one out of the five. So the Best Picture hasn't come up yet. Philip Seymour Hoffman won the Best Actor Academy Award tonight for Capote, which he gives a remarkable embodiment of In Cold Blood author Truman Capote. And George Clooney won the Best Supporting Actor for the oil industry thriller Syriana. And Rachel Weisz took the Supporting Actress Prize for another corporate thriller, The Constant Gardener. The John Le Carré book made into a film, actually a terribly depressing book, very well done, about pharmaceutical companies and how they function in Africa. And yeah, I was reading, I don't need to give these people any more publicity than they're able to hog as it is, but I was reading a number of right-wing commentators about the Oscars. And they hate the Oscars. They hate the actors. You know, they hate the films. One of them said she hadn't seen a single one, wouldn't go to see them. Because all five are liberal or left films. And, you know, the deal is, if you think about it, culture is now, and almost always has been, a liberal, left, rebellious, set of creative impulses. I mean, you can't be a real traditional. That's not to say there has been traditional painters, traditional composers, and what have you. But certainly, overwhelmingly, that the people that through the ages that have made up the creative spirit have been rebels. People that have said no to the status quo, no to the government, no to what's expected of them. And that's why the right wing hates them so much. And you know, there's this one book called Shut Up and Sing, where this right-wing commentator takes on this fascist, essentially, perspective and says, you can't give your opinion. You're a famous actor or singer or whatever. We want you just to entertain us. We want you to be our little monkey on a string, unless, of course, there's a couple right-wing actors, and I don't know, must be at least one or two right-wing rock musicians, right? I can think of a couple. Most of them, though, tend towards liberal causes because that's part of the creative spirit, connecting with humanity. And the right-wing conservatives, they don't have that connection. It's all about them. It's all about maybe, if they get a little farther out, people just like them, whoever they happen to be. In this country, it's pretty easy to see. So all this stuff pisses them off totally. The fact that all these films have liberal themes, that it's about gays, you know, suddenly they're not portrayed as being these awful people that wind up, of course, from what I know of Brokeback Mountain, that certainly ended in tragedy. Also, they must be fuming. How about this? Foaming, because they are sort of foamers, you know, foaming at the mouth that this hip-hop tune, It's Hard Out There for a Pimp from Hustle and Flow, won Best Song. I mean, I was really surprised at that. I saw a little bit of it all before I left for work here, and they had to, what are they called? Expletives, swearing words. So they kept talking about witches. Obviously, they were talking about bitches, but they didn't want to say that on ABC, you know, with this new stuff going on. So, you know what I got to say about these right-wingers? Screw them. It's pretty clear who makes the music, who makes the films, who makes the art. I mean, fascists can't make art. They do a little. Once in a while, you get some right-winger who can paint. Salvador Dali, the great surrealist painter, for some reason or other, cozied up to the fascist dictator Franco in the 40s and what have you. But on the other hand, all the surrealists, all the great surrealists, all the great modern painters, Picasso and all that, again, way raving leftists. And what that says, it says, I don't want to get into too much of the details and the asterisks and the footnotes of it all, because it's all pretty complex. But let me say that, and sometimes, well, here's what I was going to say. Sometimes they were mistaken in where they put their political allegiance, because they thought they were putting it alongside of a movement that said it was for freedom and equality and what have you. And, of course, some of these political movements, when they moved into having the power of the political state, turned out to be, just dictatorships. But the impulse that moved artists to support left-wing principles of generosity, tolerance, equality, respect for other people, something that's unknown to the right, they're the opposite. They're the absolute opposite of that. Let's see if there's anything more in here. March of the Penguins was a surprise smash at the box office. I saw that. Best documentary. For some reason or other, the right wing liked that. They said it showed the hand of God or something like that. You know, it really gave them a sense of the Lord being present in these penguins down in Antarctica. I mean, if anything, it would give you the opposite impression. Did anybody, any of you see that? You might. Oh, by the way, I forgot. We got a phone number here. If not, I just talk all night. 313-298-WRIF. 313-298-WRIF. And you can go to calltalkyes@yahoo.com if you have an email remark. Short, please. calltalkyes@yahoo.com. And anyways, March of the Penguins. So these Christian fundamentalists were all over this documentary, March of the Penguins, because they said, for one thing, it showed they were monogamous. Well, I mean, they were down in this in Antarctica when it's like 40 below zero. They didn't have time for anything else. They didn't have time to have multiple partners or anything like that. And then it was serial monogamy. Right? Because in the next year, they got another partner. Oh, yeah, yeah. This shows that God exists because these penguins, I don't know. I mean, what is with this? Is this like a royal joker for a creator? I got an idea. I'm going to put these birds at the bottom of the world where they're going to freeze their butts off and have to stand in 40-mile-an-hour winds and it's 60, 70 below wind chill, and then they're going to march to the sea and get eaten by seals. Ha, 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 ha. Because I am the god of hellfire, right? Whatever. So I never saw that. I like the documentary. So I'm glad I got that. Anything else? Yeah. So what are I think the right wing tonight? What are they doing? They're probably just watching their DVD copies of The Passion of the Christ again or something like that. They haven't tuned in. All right. Any comments about the Oscars or anything like that? Let me know. 313-298-WRIF. Wait a minute here. I don't even know what the hell they're choosing now. But I rarely do this. I don't know how Larry McMurtry and somebody else. What would that be for? I don't know. Don't worry about it. We'll announce this all for you. This is more fun. 313-298-WRIF. My website, a lot of new good stuff on there, peterwerby.com, PETERWERBE.com. Oh, maybe for Brokeback Mountain. Got something. Yeah. What the hell. That'll really send the righties over the edge. Good. Good. Stay over the edge. Go someplace else. Don't bother us. You know, we just bother you by the fact that we exist. You know, people on the left and everything like that. You don't bother us by the fact that you exist and you exhibit the kind of weird behavior and weird ideas. It's only when you try to shove it down our throats that we get our backs up. And that's what you're all about, because you're authoritarians. You're totalitarians. You're trying to totalize your beliefs, your experiences. So I don't care what you do, you can have whatever little thoughts in your mind, as long as you don't try to lay them on anybody else, because when you do, it always causes war and discrimination and hatred and all that. All right, I want to do one other thing as well. I don't know what to call this. We're going to have a little segment called Rumor Control. Let's call it Rumor Control. This is new. Rumor Control. We'll call it that. I get so many emails with things saying, is this true or is this not true? And I don't know. Sometimes I know they're true. Sometimes I don't know they're true. I almost get a sense after doing this for a lot of years what is true and what isn't. So what I would ask you to do would be to send me rumors that you've picked up probably through the internet. No jokes. I mean, you heard that what's his name? Donald Rumsfeld, the Secretary of War, is actually arrived here via the Venusian space fleet. All right, that's not a rumor. That's just silly. That's stupid. But here's two that I have heard. And one of them, someone wrote and asked me, and I said I had no idea. But it is that the Secret Service has said that Bush cannot hunt with Dick Cheney. So that sounds like a joke, right? On the other hand, something really weird happened out there a week or so ago when Cheney blasted his friend in the face. And from what I understand, Bush and Cheney, and someone remind me whether this has actually occurred. Have Bush and Haney, Cheney hunted together? I think so. 313-298-WRIF, whether they have or not. So, I mean, what if Cheney would have shot Bush in the face? Wow, wouldn't that have been really over the edge? Maybe they were arguing, people would have said they were arguing about who was really president. But anyways, so this is the rumor that Bush, this is the Secret Service calling the shots, can no longer hunt with Dick Cheney. I have no idea whatsoever whether this is true or not. All right, here's one. And I don't even know what the origin of it is. Here's another one. This is from Insight Magazine. Now, this is owned by the Moonies, this crazy right-wing religious figure who says he's Jesus Christ and owns, like, the Washington Times and stuff like that. So, other publications. Owns publications around the world. Vice President Dick Cheney is expected to retire within a year. Senior GOP sources envision the retirement of Mr. Cheney in 2007, months after the congressional election. Sources said Mr. Cheney would be persuaded to step down as he becomes an increasing political liability to President Bush. The sources reported a growing rift between the president and vice president, as well as their staff. Maybe that's because Bush is trying to say, hey, I'm the president. I'm the president. Hey, by the way, we have some open lines for you. 313-298-WRIF. So this is a little bit better sourced, but still, you know, the way it says sources. Now, Cheney is an extraordinary political liability. His approval rating is at 29%. Now, I usually say that about a third of the country, a third of any modern industrial country, is pure fascist. That they could show films of Bush participating in cannibalism and they would still support him. And they'd have some cuckamamie theory why it was all right that they heard on some right-wing talk show who figured it out why it was really okay. And they weren't even seeing that he was eating somebody else's brain or something like that. Anyways, Cheney has even lost that because Bush now, it's at 34% his approval rating. So that's the fascist third, 33 and a third. What's his name? Cheney has even lost that. He's down to 29%, which must be a massive, massive loss. 5% there. Okay, your turn. 313-298-WRIF. And nobody wants to comment on the Oscars or these rumors? Yeah, hey, man. Yeah. I can do this for a long time. But, let me see. I'll just flipped one of my screens off here. Let me click it back on. Hello, hello. Will it work? Yeah, there we go. All right. Every time I think we've passed some state that things can't get any worse, Bushco, Bush Incorporated, the corporate racket, made up of these criminally incompetent figures that control the destiny of our lives and the world, do something more. Remember last week I said, what are they going to break next? What are they going to screw up next? I mean, if you think about it, that these administrations, the administration's history since January 20th, 2001, has been this history of one catastrophic event after the next. Almost every one, well, why am I being so nice? Every one of which Bushko has screwed up, right? Well, the newest thing is that after decades of U.S. policy, Bush has now brought India into the world's exclusive nuclear club. He was over there, right? And why the hell does he go over there? So that hundreds of thousands of people can protest against him and the U.S., burn U.S. flags. Maybe he thinks that when he goes there and you see all these dark-skinned people burning the United States flag, that people go, "Ooh, I hate them dark-skinned people that are burning the American flag. I love Big Brother. I mean, I love George Bush. I love you because he's the opposite of them. He's white. He's got a suit on. He's got a little flag in his lapel. Who do I identify with?" Well, I identify with the Indian protesters. Why didn't anybody in the United States ever think about this slogan? They had signs that said, "I am Bush." Right? That's easy to understand. This is actually more visual. "I am Bush." And then the second line, it said, "I am Bush." You know, like an ambush, A-M-B-U-S-H. That's pretty cool. "I am Bush, I am Bush." So I suspect you'll see that around. So Bush rewards this nuclear rogue state, India, that that refused any inspection of its nuclear facilities and certainly would not allow its military facilities. Remember, they were rattling these nuclear sabers in Pakistan, India and Pakistan, a little while ago, which was totally scary. Anyways, Bush has now agreed with, you know, this is us, to share nuclear reactors, fuel, and expertise with what's called an energy-starved nation in return for its acceptance of international safeguards. Go, ooh, well, that's cool. Maybe they figured it out, how they could kind of rein them in a little. Well, it's not the case. Well, for one thing, this is another giveaway of Bushko to the pretty much moribund, in other words, ain't happening, U.S. nuclear industry. Because who's going to be selling these big reactors? Well, it's not going to be French firms. It's going to be U.S. firms. So this is billions of dollars are going to be pumped in to the U.S. economy. And, oh, you say, well, that's good. Well, you and I aren't going to share much of that. You better believe that. In fact, average income is dropping. It's dropping. Yep. And the accord took 8 months and would end India's long isolation as a nuclear maverick that defied world appeals and developed nuclear weapons. Gee, who else does that sound like? It's, I can't really remember. Oh, yeah, Iran. Iran. That's the deal. That's right. So Iran, did this happen? I'm wondering. Oh no, never mind. I was watching television. Every talk show host in the world has the monitor on. It drives me absolutely insane. Takes my ADD brain even more so off my line of thinking. All right. So what's happening? It's India and Iran are identical, absolutely identical in what they're doing, except we don't know for sure that Iran has a nuclear weapon. We know they don't. Actually, we know that they do not. We're not 100% sure that that's what they're doing. And many people think that even if they would like to, Iran, that they don't actually have the capacity to do so. They don't have the capacity to do so. But India, in defiance of international law, has nuclear weapons, refuses inspection, and refuses to sign the Nuclear Non-Proliferation Treaty. This is like an outlaw rogue nation that Bush has sidled up to and made an agreement to send our reactors, our fuel, and our expertise to go along with it. You say, oh, well, now they've accepted international safeguards and inspections. Well, not exactly. They have 22 facilities, and they've declared 14 of them commercial facilities, and 8 is military. And the military, you ain't looking at those, buddy. Nobody is. So why is Bush doing this? Well, the main crass explanation is what I always said. It's more to giveaways to his corporate buddies in the nuclear industry. But it's also seeing India as a potential, all of a sudden the noun is out of my brain. Sort of a hedge, but I want another word in that. Another chess piece against China. Against China. This would, of course, ratchet up the possibility of nuclear war in Asia. And also, against our wonderful anti-terrorist ally, Pakistan. Because Pakistan, as well, has nuclear weapons and is a hair's breadth away from having a Taliban-like government. Because Musharraf, the dictator, one of our democratic buddies, right, seized power in a coup in 1999 and has been involved in India in mutual saber rattling. So it's an extraordinarily dangerous situation, and there are options. George Bush, well, I mean, it's ridiculous to say that he would. An American president, perhaps the one that should have been seated in 2001 and the one that should have been seated in 2005, the Democratic candidates, both of who had their the election stolen from them, could have begun to make create a world based on nuclear disarmament rather than nuclear proliferation and armament. Now, this all brings the world more and more in danger from this. And in the lead of making life more dangerous for us, George W. Bush and Bushco. Now, Iran has threatened to embark on full-scale uranium enrichment if the United Nations nuclear watchdog presses for action over its nuclear program. It says it's going to, if they even gets criticized, man, they're going to react really badly. The over-the-top far-right-wing U.S. ambassador to the United Nations, John Bolton, warned of possibilities of, quote, painful consequences for Iran if they go ahead with this. Painful consequences. And, I'm faking something here, and I'll tell you why in just a second. All right, they just announced Best Picture, and Best Picture is Crash. Wow, the L.A. film, essentially an anti-racist film. Crash, the best, just won Best Picture. Another film that the righties all hated. Too bad, isn't it? Anyways, painful consequences will be suffered by Iran, according to John Bolton. Again, making the world less safe by making threats. Now, rather than going through all of it, Iran, quote, said Bolton, told a conference of the American-Israel Public Affairs Committee, interesting place to make this threat, Iran, quote, must be made aware that if it continues down the path of international isolation, there will be tangible and painful consequences. Well, it didn't happen to India. The United States president is over there saying, hey, we're going to give you reactors. We're going to sell them to you. We're going to make them available. Fuel and expertise. So why should Iran feel any different about the situation? And no, oh, they're going to get a little hard time, but then, you know, pretty soon they'll be accepted in as a full nuclear partner. The only thing is that it kind of confounds the United States' ability to extend military power 6,000 miles away from our home in the Middle East. If there's a country that has the capacity to checkmate the United States, because if you have weapons of mass destruction, as we've talked about so many times in this show, you don't get invaded like North Korea. If you do have them like North Korea, you don't get invaded. If you don't have them, like Iraq didn't, and Bush Co. knew that they didn't have them, then you do get invaded. So what about these consequences? Who could really be hurt if the United States either began diplomatic pressure against Iran or worse, bombed some of these facilities in there? Well, it could really precipitate all hell breaking loose in the Middle East. For one thing, Muqtada Sadr, head of the Sadr militia, said that, and because you got to remember, most of these Shiites in Iraq, the guys that we're putting into office, the people we think are our puppets that are part of the new quote democratic Iraq, they're aligned with the Iranians. The Shiites in Iran Iran sheltered them, helped them, gave them money during the time Saddam Hussein was in power, because Iran hated Saddam Hussein, and all of that. So what Iran has said that it will do is it will cut off oil completely to the west. So, well, maybe somebody out there saying, "Well, I don't know, we invade them." That worked out real well in Iraq. Remember Representative John Murtha of Philadelphia? He was the decorated Vietnam veteran, retired from the Marine Corps Reserve as a colonel in 1990. He's the one that called for immediate withdrawal from Iraq. He says, "We have a situation where our military is in such bad shape it couldn't deploy to a second front." Murtha says, "And the Iranians know this. North Korea knows it. China knows it. We're depleting our resources in Iraq. So Bushko has screwed us. Big time." All right. Let me get your calls. Grab the phones right now. Oscars, Iran, Iraq, whatever. Want to hear from you. Peter Werby here with you on Night Call. 313-298-WRIF. Also, if you have any thoughts, any rumors that you've heard that you'd like to check with me, and the ones that I said was that Bush, according to Secret Service dictate, can no longer hunt with Dick Cheney. And that Cheney is expected, a second one, Cheney is expected to retire within a year. Anybody with any information on those or opinions on any of it, I'd like to hear from you. 313-298-WRIF.
You're listening to WRIF.com.
Think you have what it takes to be the next Riff Rock Girl? 101 WRIF and the Tri-County Pontiac GMC dealers, along with MGM Grand Detroit Casino, are looking for one very special woman to be the 2006 Riff Rock Girl. Think you can handle a $30,000 year-long contract? How about your choice of a new Pontiac or GMC? A Riff ad inside Stuff magazine? Oh yeah. And you'll be a star in a Riff TV commercial. Go ahead and mark it in your day planner now. The first casting call to find the Riff Rock Girl will be at March 4th between 3 p.m. and 7 p.m. at GameWorks inside Great Lakes Crossing in Auburn Hills. If you're 21 or older, bring your bio and a photo of yourself to one of the RIF's three auditions. For more details and official rules, visit WRIF.com. Are you the next RIF Rock Girl? The 2006 RIF Rock Girl Search. Presented by Tri-County Pontiac GMC Dealers. Also brought to you in part by MGM Grand Detroit Casino, where the city shines. And 101 WRIF. Everything. Rocks.
This is WRIF.com.
We're back with more Night Call on 101 WRIF Detroit. Here's Peter Werby.
All right, thank you very much and welcome back. Three things we're talking about is the Oscars and how the right-wingers hate all the actors and they hate all the themes, particularly the five the movies that were in the running for the best picture. Crash won. But the themes, gay themes and anti-racist themes and all that, they just hate that stuff. And they hate the fact that overwhelmingly creative, artistic people are to the left. They can't get their brains around it. They can't get their brains around it because their brains are so rigid, and there's not any right-wing, a couple, but there's very few right-wing creative people because you can't have a rigid brain and be creative, right? All right, the other thing, rumors, this is going to be a constant feature on Night Call. Rumor control. So, two. One that I heard that Bush is no longer allowed to hunt with Cheney, and according to the Secret Service. And the other thing is that Cheney's expected to retire within a year. And I've got one. Let me see if I can find this. Yeah. Ryan in Ann Arbor wrote into calltalkyes@yahoo.com. If the rumors are true, I think it would be the same reason Bill Kristol is recently shredding Bush in the media. The neocons are preparing for the 2008 elections. Cheney will not run for prez, but a new VP might. Yeah, that's what I think is going on. They're going to put like Condoleezza Rice or somebody like that in there. But yeah, I think Cheney could very, very well. I think that's accurate. All right, let's do some telephone calls, and let's go to Mike in Dearborn Heights. Mike, hi, it's Peter Werby. You're on the air.
Yeah, how you doing? Great show, first time caller.
Well, welcome.
I find it interesting how we can go over to India and dangle the carrot in front of the horse, so to speak.
Uh-huh.
To try to get some democracy in the area. And, reward a nation that is, generally Democrat with some, like Republicans typically are big business. And so they're trying to show in the region that if you do what we like, this is your payoff.
Sure. But, we pay for the payoff always, though, the average taxpayer.
Right. Well, and the middleman or, the middle the blue-collar worker that's losing their jobs to the outsourcing in that area is just terrible.
Yeah, I don't think Bush talked about that much either.
Well, what I did notice, I thought it laughable, is that he said, Americans, we can retrain and relearn. And over here he says one thing, but when he's over there, he says, outsourcing is not that bad a thing. He said it in a speech. I was just floored.
Yeah. Well, there's so much. In fact, every time Bush opens his mouth, we're floored. Literally. All right. Thanks, Mike. Appreciate it. Let's see. Here's Stan in Garden City. Stan, hi. It's Peter Werby. You're on the air.
All right, Peter. How you doing?
Doing great. Thanks.
I haven't talked to you in a while. You're down in South America last time I talked on the line, but welcome back.
Oh, yeah. I was in Venezuela saying hello to Hugo Chavez.
That's good. You know, he's a good guy trying to help us out on the cheaper oil.
Yeah.
But other than that, our president ain't doing much. I want to talk about Iran and a House resolution that Thaddeus McCotter, the 11th District, he's trying to get support with Jim Sexton, New Jersey. And the House resolution 152 is just a resolution. It's not law. It's just a bill. But it's trying to get passed to help put military action against the Iranian regime right now. And what my question to you is, sir, is twofold. One, if Iran does start playing hardball, how would this affect oil prices here at home, since they're like, what, the fourth or fifth largest oil regime in the country over there, in the Arab country?
Well, they'd go through the ceiling. They'd go absolutely through the ceiling. They're starting to go up anyways. I was just looking at gas, $2.45 again. I mean, we're starting to get ripped at the pump once again.
That's correct. Garden City, it's $2.37, and on the side of Wayne, it's $2.43 near the Ford plant there on Michigan Ave. And my second question to you, if you can rebuke this, would be, how is it necessary to condemn Iran when you have, what's-his-face up there, Bolton condemning it on the Internet I'm reading?
Mm-hmm.
How is this even reasonable to go to war with this country I mean, this is going to destroy us all, man.
Well, one thing, the United States cannot go to war with Iran. Certainly, Iraq, which had an army of dust, and look what the quagmire that we're in now. We just passed 2,300 American deaths and, who knows, 15,000 critically wounded Americans, over 100,000 Iraqi civilians killed. And that's just irregulars, insurgents. Iran has a modern, intact, formidable army. And the United States, as Representative Murtha said, who knows about war from Vietnam, unlike all the chicken hawks, Bush and his pals, says there's no way that we could do anything. Yeah, I mean, we could probably bomb them, but they have like 300 facilities. And as I said, that could just widen the war in Iraq. Bush has put us into an awful position. All right, thank you very much. I appreciate it. I appreciate your call. Let's go to Drew. Drew, hi, it's Peter Werby. You're on the air. This is Drew Bardell, right?
Yeah, hi, Peter. How you doing tonight?
Yeah, welcome to the show. Tell people you've got something pretty good going on this coming Saturday. What's it all about?
Yeah, March 11th. Down at the Magic Stick, the Majestic Theater Complex in Detroit. We're putting on a little protest rally, bringing the community together with art, poetry, public speaking, a platform for ideas, so to speak, the people's protest against war profiteering. So, you know, I encourage people to come on out and voice their opinion, whatever it may be. That's really what it's all about.
And you got, what, 10 bands, though, too. So it's we used to say loud noise, good cause.
Yeah, it's probably been a lot of years since they've said that in Detroit.
Yeah, well, it's time.
Unfortunately, really. And that's kind of what we're hoping to do here. We're hoping to inspire a little bit of, volume in the dissent as far as the direction of our country.
Well, you are, in many ways, the opening salvo in the period from March 11th through to April 29th, when there's going to be a million-person march in New York City. And I know on March 11th also at noon, Plymouth, Michigan, the women in black are going to have an anti-war demonstration. And then at night at the Magic Stick down near Wayne State University, your rally and music event. And then the next week, March 18th, which is the third anniversary of Bush's lying, unnecessary, illegal war, there's going to be demonstrations all over the country. There's going to be in downtown Detroit, in Northville, Ann Arbor, a jillion places.
Absolutely, and that's good. I mean, the outrage is apparent. It's no mystery. The people are completely disheveled with what's going on. You know, it's really hard to wrap your brain around it. And because the media is bought and sold, they're not doing their job in this country. There's no regard for future generations, and people are just, I don't know. It's outrage that needs to happen. I mean,
I agree. You know, Drew, and the only thing I'd kind of little disagreement, in many ways, they are doing their job. I mean, they're set up to confuse and misinform people. Yeah, that's why.
No, I mean, if you look at it at that angle, I absolutely agree with you.
I mean, all throughout American history, whenever there's been these massive protest movements from anti-slavery to the giving women the vote, opposing the war, the labor movement, the anti-war movement, as you start to go into the 60s and all of that, there's always had to be the creation of an alternative press, because it was always print media then. And the only reason there hasn't been this enormous upsurge in newspapers the way they were during the 1960s, when there was hundreds and hundreds of what they called alternative or underground newspapers, is because we mostly now depend on the internet. I wouldn't even bother. I watch the nightly news maybe once a month.
That's good. That's good.
I mean,
I would recommend that for anybody.
Yeah, yeah.
That's the medicine that you need. But, what we're trying to do is we're trying to pull the whole community together, the artists, the soccer moms, the poets, the transgenders, I don't care, the hookers, the nuns, we're trying to pull them all together. it's basically a platform for ideas, you know.
Yeah,
tired of the few controlling the masses.
Right. But I assume you want ordinary people there too.
Absolutely.
Besides hookers and nuns. I want to see the hookers and nuns together.
Well, I'm just trying to show the, like,
I got you.
The stratosphere of where we, you know, yeah, where we're reaching. But, you know, I mean, the action is for the people. And, unfortunately, corporate America has completely hijacked our government. And, you know, it, a lot of people feel that, you know, this is completely belligerent and unconstitutional and illegal.
Sure.
And, you know, it seems like there's a complacency that is frightening at this point.
Well, you know,
calming down, and that's maybe I turn my attention to the media, but it's a bigger problem than the media, you know.
You know what, Drew? I actually was talking to someone. Many people say nobody cares. Everyone's apathetic. And I said to him, I said to this DJ that works here, I said, I'm not trying to put you on the spot, but I said, what are you doing? He said, what do you mean? I said, well, don't you think there might be other people just like you that also think that nobody's doing anything because you're not doing anything? And he said, you know, you're right. He said, tell me about some stuff. So I said, well, let me send you, since he's a rock and roll DJ, let me send you the information on this event that's happening at the Magic Stick down in the Majestic Complex next Saturday. And he said, wow, yeah, it's great. I didn't know people were doing anything. That's why it's important to link on. I mean, if I don't know if my calendar is the best, it probably isn't, but if you go to Peter Werbe, werbe.com, and then go to my calendar, you can find out about these events that not only to me are an ethical imperative to stop these elitist, greedy, constitution shredders, but also it links you up with people that value the planet and the people and the animals that live on it, as opposed to these planet wreckers that are in control of everything. All right, Drew Bardo, tell us you know what when it's at the Magic Stick. At what time does it start?
The doors are at 7 p.m.
Yeah,
and we have an entire lineup set to go about 7:30. We got bands such as Friends of Dennis Wilson, Bad Faces Clan, Jawbone, the One Man Blues Machine here in Detroit,
mm-hmm.
Heroes and Villains, Velvet Audio, The Dead Bodies, Freer, Audra Kubat, Scotty Crotty, and Scotch Bonnet are going to do a little thing. We got guest speakers. We were hoping to get you down there, Peter, actually. We send all of our accolades, and I've been listening to you for a long time. I think you're a true American patriot in the truest sense, and I completely admire you, and I can't say that I would be doing what I'm doing right now, organizing such a rally, a meeting of the minds, if it wasn't for a person like you.
Wow, I can't get a better compliment than that. That's really nice of you to say.
It's almost like carrying the torch in some ways. We feel like,
yeah,
you know, what happened to where's our generation's MC5? The Soledad Brothers? Well, they moved to England, you know. So
well, we've got a lot of bands. In fact, sounds like you've got 10 of them. All right, I should move on, but I'd like to come down. I will
We'd
email you.
We'd love to have you down there. Maybe give a word or two. No pressure, nothing like that, you know.
No, it's no pressure. I think you guys are doing wonderful stuff, and I'd like to be part of it. I will email you tomorrow. So give us a quick wrap-up, now without naming all the bands, about when and where this is all going to be, and is there a website, or should
well, this is all happening in downtown Detroit at the Magic Stick Saturday, March 11th. It's 18 and over. Doors are at 7 p.m. It's a free event, free admission. It's information awareness. The goal is to gain momentum and to potentially host something outdoors, either in the summer or the fall, early fall. But we want to get a lot of causes together for the same cause, really. And stand in unity here in the local community and then maybe take it nationally. But it's against war profiteering, basically. And there's a lot of information, a lot of literature, a lot of different things about contacting senators and congressmen and things of that nature.
Great.
That you can gather while you're there. And there's going to be some great entertainment, and we're really going to kick it up a notch. And hopefully there's no flashing blue lights at the end of the night.
Well, you've sold me, and I'm cop-proof, so maybe I should come down. Drew Bardo, thanks.
Well, then I'm hanging out with you, Peter.
All right, thanks for putting this all together. And is there a website, or should they just go to mine?
If they go to yours, they can get all the information,
all right.
Basically.
Great. Thank you so much. Thanks for doing this.
fabulous, man. Thanks for having me, Peter.
Yeah, and I'll be in touch with you tomorrow. All right, Drew Bardo putting together this event this Saturday. A lot of you say, what can I do? Where there's nothing happening. Well, here's one thing that's happening, and also you know, a lot of good entertainment. It's going to go from 7 p.m. till 2 a.m. at the Magic Stick this Saturday, and also it's going to be kicking off a whole period of anti-war demonstrations. So if you feel it, do it, right? Peter Werbe with you here on WRIF's Night Call, 313-298-WRIF. Here's Kurt in Gibraltar. Kurt, hi, it's Peter Werbe. You're on the air.
Hi, Peter. How are you tonight?
Doing great. Thanks for calling in.
Oh, no problem. First of all, I'd like to say, one, I don't like our President Bush. I didn't vote for Bush. I don't agree with his politics. I think he has this thing all so screwed up that even if he could get out of it, I don't think he'd know how to do it. Having said that, I do have to disagree with this thing about Iran. And the reason I disagree is these people, I heard you earlier, the difference with these people in Iran is they want to kill us. Whatever their parliament or whatever it is they have over there,
yeah.
You know, they can't death to America, you know. These people want to kill us, and we're going to let them get a nuclear weapon?
Well, I think it's a bad idea. I'm actually, Kurt, much more frightened about Pakistan, which already has a bomb. Nobody should have a nuclear weapon, and everything should be done possible to stop you know, any country from developing it or having access to the wherewithal to produce more, like Bush is giving India. You know, if we weren't in their face, if we didn't have an army, in some cases, 50 miles from their borders, if we hadn't messed with their government and overthrew, 50 years ago now, but they got some good memories of the dictatorship that the United States put into Iran, they wouldn't have this hostility towards us. And also, what you got to do in international relations is see what people do, not what they say. Because all this death to America stuff is, plays well with the home crowd, and it makes the politicians there a little more secure from internal criticisms. That's the way people always use external threats, including Bush. So I agree with you completely that we do not want Iran to have the bomb. But you're also correct in there may not be any way now because of what Bush has done that he can stop it.
Oh yeah. I don't think he knows how to. Having said what you said, I mean, what the past is the past. I mean, they're going ahead with uranium enrichment.
Right.
So what are we going to do to solve this problem?
I have not a clue. I mean, when I talk in general that Bush, rather than always making plans for war, should make plans for peace, you can say, well, gee, can you make peace with some people that are saying death to America? I don't know. He ought to at least begin to try. It doesn't mean you got to give up anything. Doesn't mean you have to, surrender anything or anything like that. But, if we can't all get along, I don't mean to sound like Rodney King, we're in some very, very bad trouble. All right, Kurt, thank you very much. Appreciate your call. Here is John in Ypsilanti. John, hi. It's Night Call, and you're on the air.
Hey, Peter. How are you?
Good.
Long-time listener, young one. I'm only 22, but ever since I have radio, I've been hearing. So,
great.
Big fan. I called to ask about a rumor that I heard on the internet, read on the internet, and I don't trust the internet all the time, so it might just be BS. But I read somewhere that OPEC was considering transferring the, monetary equivalent for standardizing crude oil to the euro as opposed to the U.S. dollar. Have you heard anything about this?
Well, no, that's been that's one of the big threats to the United States economy. Some people say that when Saddam Hussein in 1990 started talking about trading in petro-euros rather than petro-dollars, that sealed his fate. I mean, of course, Saddam Hussein was a big friend of the Republican administrations in the 80s and acted at U.S. behest and all that. But when he started talking that stuff, it was bye-bye. And if the dollar ceases to be the major instrument of international exchange, it could be pretty ugly. So every once in a while, you'll get somebody like Hugo Chavez of Venezuela that starts, that loves to trash talk Bush, threatening the same thing. To tell you the truth, I don't know what I don't know what the possibilities of all that is, because the idea, for instance, now that the United States is a debtor nation, other hostile or I don't even know, maybe shouldn't even say hostile countries, governments with issues with the United States, they don't want us to go bankrupt. I mean, one of the greatest ways to ensure you're around is to remain a debtor, because we're paying. I mean, China and Japan and wherever else we're getting operating funds for now that Bush has made us into a debtor nation. So I don't know. All right, thank you very much. Appreciate your call. We're going to take a break. Be right back to get your calls. 313-298-WRIF. We have open lines for you.
This is WRIF.com. And now, a word from the Riff Legal Eagles. Unless otherwise stated, all entrants for WRIF contests must be at least 18 years of age and a legal resident of the United States. A household is eligible to win one contest per 30 days every 6 months for prizes valued at $600 or higher. Greater Media Detroit and its affiliates, promotional sponsors, advertising and promotional agencies, and other radio and television stations in the Detroit ADI are not eligible to participate. One entry per person. No purchase or other consideration is necessary to participate in the contest. Void where prohibited. Prizes are not transferable or redeemable for cash. 101 WRIF reserves the right to substitute any prize for one of equal or greater value. By participating in the contest, contestants consent to the broadcast and or publication of their name, voice, face, and or likeness without compensation. Participants listening online at www.wrif.com may receive audio that is delayed by as much as 60 seconds later than the over-the-air transmission, which could potentially affect chances of winning. General contest rules are available online at www.wrif.com or during regular business hours at the WRIF Studios, 1 Radio Plaza, Detroit, Michigan, 482-220.
You're listening to WRIF.com.
Night Call is back on 101 WRIF Detroit. Here's your host, Peter Werby.
All right, thank you very much. This is our second hour, by the way. And we'd like to hear from you. 313-298-WRIF. Nobody's really talked about the Oscars, and I'm just trying to sucker in like some right wing callers when I say that creativity is left wing. Remember? Didn't I tell you that story? Probably when it happened. It seems like I mentioned it recently during the run up to the war. Good segments of the population, millions of us knew that Bush was lying about weapons of mass destruction. Millions of us knew that Bush, that Iraq had nothing to do with 9/11. And there were Hollywood people and rock people and Broadway people that as citizens joined in the opposition. So there were a number of places that were calling all of us traitors, right? Of course, they would listen to us. We wouldn't be in the mess that we're in now. This is a major I-told-you-so deal. Unfortunately, it's on the bodies of tens of thousands of people, Americans and Iraqis. Worse to come, by the way. Nothing but more bad things happening down the line. There was this obnoxious talk show in Detroit. These two guys, fortunately, in fact, I bet them that they wouldn't be here in 6 months. And I offered to bet them $1,000. I mean, I was hoping they wouldn't call my bluff because there was no way in the world my wife would ever let me bet $1,000 on anything. But as it turned out, I would have won. And they didn't take me up on the bet. And well, they wanted to take out an ad denouncing all of these anti-war creative people as traitors. So after a while, I said, and then they listed hundreds and hundreds of them. Us. I said, add me to it, all right? I want the publicity. And I said, you're going to have to, and they were trying to raise money for an ad, which never, they couldn't, the listeners didn't come up with it. And I told them, why don't you do the opposite? Just list the pro-war people. You need, maybe need like a, you know, a quarter of a page ad or something like that. Okay. Also, oh yeah, we were talking about Iran, but also I was mentioning John Murtha, the representative from Pennsylvania, the guy that called, you know, he was a Marine hero in Vietnam. He said the U.S. presence in Iraq is hurting the worldwide war on terrorism and benefits only Iran and Al-Qaeda. Isn't that sweet? I mean, a lot of ways Bush Co. doesn't care. All they want to do is get billions. Well, here's the process. There is this transfer of wealth. You and I work, and then a good 25-30% of it is taken in taxes, and a good percentage of that is turned over to these Bush Co-connected corporations to produce all these weapons of war. Then they're destroyed in war, and they destroy a nation. We've talked about this. And then Halliburton and Bechtel and these places put it all together, and again, we pay for this. So to some extent, it doesn't even matter to Bush Co. and Halliburton and Bechtel and the Carlyle Group. Win or lose, they always win. They always win. You say, oh, Cheney's got 29% popularity. What does he care? He's a multimillionaire. Right? I mean, probably he'd like to be popular and all that. Probably would have liked to have been president. But ultimately, they're this governing, ruling elite, this class of rulers impervious to democratic controls, lie all the time, wreck everything that they come in contact with, and they come out smelling like a rose. Anyways, Murtha expressed skepticism of assurances given by General Peter Pace, the chair of the Joint Chiefs of Staff. Can you believe that he said this? Pace said the war in Iraq was going very, very well. Why doesn't anyone else think so? Murtha said, why should I believe him? This administration, including the president, has mischaracterized this war for the past 2 years. So why would I believe the chairman of the Joint Chiefs when he says things are going well? He says, Murtha, the only people who want us in Iraq are Iran and Al-Qaeda. Now, I don't believe that about Iran, but Murtha and I could disagree on that. Al-Qaeda certainly wants us there. They've been able to achieve more by the U.S. invasion and occupation of Iraq than they ever could have dreamed of. Let's see, Murtha says, and I talked to a top-level commander the other day, and he said, China wants us there also. Why? Because we're depleting our resources, our troop resources, and our financial resources. And I quoted earlier, He says the military is in such bad shape it couldn't deploy to a second front. The Iranians know this. North Korea knows this. China knows it. We're depleting our resources in Iraq. An overwhelming majority of 72% of American troops serving in Iraq think the United States should exit the country within the next year. That's within 9 months. Out of there. Mirtha says immediately. Say immediately. Just one in five of troops want to heed the Bush call to stay as long as they are needed. 20%. 80% of the troops do not want to stay there as long as Bush Co. thinks it's needed, if you can get that. Now, the only card that Bush Co. had, why in the world, after the catastrophic failure that Bush presided over on September 11, 2001, people ever saw him as a safeguard against terrorism is way beyond me. But finally, 54% of us disapprove of Bush's handling of terrorism. I mean, that's pathetic that it's even, that high. Worldwide poll shows 60% fear terror threat is worse since Bush's war. Thousands and thousands of people were interviewed in 35 countries, commissioned by the BBC World Service. Found about 60% of polls shared that view. Only 12% thought the war had reduced the chances of an attack, with 15% saying it had no effect either way. The biggest pullout call for the U.S. to pull out of Iraq came from Argentina. I don't know why. Where 80% favored getting out. It's just amazing, this man. Let me put it like I did last week. What will they break next? What will they break next? Well, they're breaking the nuclear safeguards even more by allowing India a pass to develop its military capacity for making nuclear weapons. Of course, hey, all these big nuke companies, pals of Bush, get to sell them all this stuff, right? All right, at 1 a.m. Eastern Time. We got to say that because we're broadcasting all over the world besides just in the Detroit area on WRIF. I'm going to be interviewing a friend of mine who lives in New Orleans, John Clark, and he wrote an incredible article for the Fifth Estate newspaper. You can go to fifthestate.org or go to my website, Peter Werbe, W-E-R-B-E.com, and you can link on to that. And it turns out, I figured, he's a prof at Loyola University, and I thought, he probably came from New York. 13th generation New Orleaner, if that's what you call him. In other words, his family's been in New Orleans for 13 generations since the 1730s, so that's really an incredible history, family history. Now, let me see, my second interview. I'll think of that in just a second. I can't picture who it was even. Oh, yeah. Oh, what's her name? Tamara Drought. A lot of you will like this. Why 20 and 30-somethings can't get ahead economically. Yeah, all right. All right, here's Dave and Taylor. Dave, hi, it's Peter Werbe. You're on the air. Welcome.
Good morning, Pete. I think we qualify for good morning now.
Yeah, sure.
Just wondering if you could put any credence on the rumor that Bush orchestrated 9/11. So that he could invade Iraq.
Well, that's certainly one that has been circulating for years on the Internet. There are whole sites set up to, in fact, prove that. Do I think he orchestrated it? No, I don't. I mean, I think there are such strange occurrences and questions why there wasn't a military response when they knew these planes were hijacked. And I've got some of that on my website. I've got a 911 website. I would say, you didn't ask me what I said. I have no way to confirm that rumor, but I think one of the most interesting things is that there are millions of people in the United States and around the world that have such a heinous view of George W. Bush that they think he is capable of carrying out this hideous act against his own people for political gain.
Yeah, I was just wondering, it's kind of shocking someone could do that. They were saying that his expression when he was down there in Florida didn't seem like, he had to take a number of warnings before, he even acted. And you have to wonder, wouldn't he think that he was under direct attack, maybe trying to locate him?
Well, if you think about it, that thing, my pet What was my pet? What was he reading? My pet goose? Some animal. All of a sudden, I can't remember what it is. My pet goat. That was what it was. My pet goat. It was sort of similar. He had a similar reaction when they were telling him that Katrina could be this major. It was more than likely going to be this major, have this major impact on New Orleans. All right, thanks a lot. Appreciate it. Yeah, a lot of people believe that to be the case, which removes it from rumor to fact. And that's it. I mean, is it rumor? Is it fact? But I think the most interesting thing is, as I said, that so many people believe that a politician in the United States could be that horrible. That's what I think is the most interesting. Here is Carrie. Carrie's in Canada. Where are you in? Where are you in Canada, Carrie?
London, Ontario.
Oh, so you're a bit of ways.
Yes, I am.
Go ahead. You're on the air.
Well, I want to tell you about an organization that's it's in Canada. The website's going to go up on the 11th, and what they call themselves is the World Citizenship Organization.
Okay.
Now they've been talking with some members of parliament in Canada, Australia, Sweden, Switzerland, and what they're doing is for a donation of $20, I guess it is. Anyways, I just seen the site. It went down and then come back up again. And what they do is they take that $20 and they buy property in those countries because they're negotiating with those countries that if they can get 25% of their population to sign up, they'll recognize them as citizens of the world.
Huh.
Now, they've come along and they've talked to Stephen Harper. He kind of blah, blah, blah. But they talked to the liberals who were in power before. And they're kind of keen on it, because if you can get 25% of your people in your country to go, look, we want to be world citizens instead of just Canadian citizens. We want to be responsible for what's going on in the world. If you can do it and pull it off, I mean, it's going to make the world a better place. So really the politicians are going, well, it's never going to happen. But this is the you know, the voice that people need out there to get together, because with that kind of money, you can buy property up in those countries and say, start to have, you know, some pull in what's going on, and to make one citizenship. Do you know what I mean?
I do. It's interesting. And what's the website?
It'll go back up on, like, it was down because it got shut down by somebody. I don't know about the rhetoric, what's going on, but it's called www.worldcitizenship.ca. And it's supposed to come back online March 11th. They have a whole list of rules and what they're trying to accomplish and everything. It's a really good read, and the people behind it seem to be, you know, I will say they're going to be left-wing according to that. They're more liberal. They do have some high ideals, like what they want to talk about. If you do have to, you can move on to this property that they buy, and the only thing they're going to do is it has to be run by all kinds of, like, power-friendly things, for example, mm-hmm. solar energy. Because they want to try to make a statement of, look, you know, if we're going to be world citizens, we want to make sure the world's here in 15 years, 5 years even, you know, for our kids.
Sure.
So it's kind of an interesting site. And,
it is.
Well, Carrie, I'm hoping it works.
Yeah, and I appreciate you telling us about it. Thanks for making our show international. Wow, London, Ontario. That's a bit away. I'm glad you're getting our signal. All right. I wanted to tell you about this. My friends at the Creative Arts Center in Pontiac, 47 Williams Street. Now, let me see. Don't they have a website here? They got to have one. Yeah. All right. Anyways, this is Art and the Motorcycle. And it's all this art about motorcycles. Yeah, let me see. Who did the... This is too small for me to read the print on it. But anyways, it's all this art having to do with motorcycles. And I know a number of the people, so excuse me if you're on here and I'm not mentioning your name, but Mark Arminsky, Gary Grimshaw, and Carl Lundgren, the three of them, Carl and Gary go way back into the 60s in the Grandy Ballroom posters, but Mark and Gary and Carl do the most wonderful rock posters imaginable. Lenny Sinclair, a great photographer, and am I missing anybody that I know? I mean, oh, Stanley Mouse. Wow. Stanley Mouse, incredible. Did all these Grateful Dead album covers and did the Mitch Ryder and Detroit Wheels cover and all that. Anyways, this is Saturday, March 11th, and it goes through Saturday, April 8th, but they're going to have the opening reception to meet the artists on Saturday, March 11th at 6 p.m. to 9 p.m. So here's what I'm going to do. I'm going to check this out at 6 o'clock. Then I'm going to go down to the Magic Stick, where there's this anti-war profiting rally going on. 10 bands. That's the Magic Stick down south of Wayne State University in the Majestic Complex. And then I'm going to head out to the New Way Bar, where my pals in the band Free Beer are playing. Isn't that a great name? So they have posters, and it always says Free Beer at the New Way Bar in Ferndale. All right, but check this out. Anytime you know you don't get any of this, and you go, wait a minute, I want to go to that, but I didn't hear any of the information, and I'm driving in my car, and I couldn't get it, you can just email me at calltalkyes@yahoo.com. Calltalkyes@yahoo.com. All right, let's go to BB in, is it Canton?
Yes.
Hey.
Hi.
Hi, you're on the air.
Hi, Mr. Werby, how you doing?
Good. Hey, Dad, there's a call for you. Oh, me. That's for me. Okay, go ahead.
I just want to say kudos. You're getting things started, and it's wonderful to see people starting to get involved and do some. But I have three things I'd like to express or
sure.
talk about. Or first of all, if the Democrats not getting off of their lazy butts and doing anything about corruption that Bush Inc. or Bush Call that you call them have created, I mean, the list is a whole page long. And then the other thing is, if by chance, I mean, I can only pray, if Bush does get impeached,
yeah.
does this mean that Cheney's going to be our president, or can we create some type of bipartisan committee, since it involves his whole administration, or practically his whole administration? And another thing, it boggles my mind when I hear some of these Republicans get on the phone talking to you about, oh, you're the traitor and this and that. Those are the most irrational, intolerant people I've met. I've had friends of mine, and they vote Republican because they think they're going to get rich. Well, first of all, you got to get rich first. You're not going to get rich
yeah.
while the 10%, 20% are getting rich off of you. And I swear, if Charles Manson ran as a Republican candidate, they'd vote for him just because of that fact. They're irrational and intolerant. And I just boggles my mind when I hear
that. Well, I told you, BB, that I think if they saw films of Bush partaking in cannibalism, they would still support him. All right. Thanks a lot. Thanks for calling in. Let's go to Justin in Ann Arbor. Justin, hi. It's Peter Werby. You're on the air.
Hi, Peter. How are you doing?
Doing good.
Two comments and then one question.
Sure.
First, it was about a week ago, CBS actually came out with a poll putting Cheney's approval rating at 18%.
Yeah, I'd heard, actually, I was listening to a talk show, and they were arguing whether it was 14% or 18%. I was giving him
that low, what's the difference, right?
Yeah, yeah.
This morning with the Meet the Press interview with General Pace, Tim Russert had mentioned something to him that someone had asked Jaleel about, I think it is, whoever the interim prime minister is in Iraq.
Right.
They asked him about his influences and who he's reading, and he mentioned Chomsky. So I thought that was kind of interesting.
Really? Wow.
Yeah. Pace didn't seem too happy about that.
There you go.
That was good for a chuckle. Three, I wanted to ask you, have you heard anything about the incident in the high school in Colorado this week?
You mean where the teacher was suspended for,
mm-hmm.
You know what? I printed that story out. And then when I came here, I realized that it didn't print out. So I didn't have it. But the teacher was, making comments about Bush, and he was suspended. Right.
Right. A kid had brought a tape recorder into class and recorded the conversation. Apparently, you know, the guy had done this more than once. So the kid, you know, shows it to his right wing dad, who then shops it out to this right wing radio hack there in town, and bingo bango, next thing you know, Fox News picks it up. So.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's
welcome to the land of the free speech.
Yeah, exactly.
Thank you.
Times, I suppose.
Thank you, Justin.
All right.
Appreciate it. Let me just read some emails here. Hugo wrote in to calltalkyes@yahoo.com. Just thought I'd pass this along. The 2,300 figure, which I said earlier we had hit the 2,300 mark, we may have even of American dead in Iraq, doesn't count U.S. troops who got wounded in Iraq and died either at Ramstein Air Force Base, Walter Reed, or in transit. Yeah, it's true. In one of these medical centers. Yes, when a soldier dies on the medevac transport plane, they're not counted among the war dead once the plane is airborne. So I've said that. In fact, if you go to my website where I have this connection, a link, rather, to the war dead, it says this has got to be seen as a minimum. And also there's a couple hundred more of the coalition of the billing, the ones that Bushko paid our tax dollars to come to Iraq to support him as well. So there's another couple hundred. So the figure for the pathetic coalition is really about 2,500 deaths. And let's see, there's a couple more. Bill writes, and I've been listening to your show, and I feel hopeless about Bushko. How do we get Bush out? Here's what we should do is contact our congressman and tell them to impeach Bushko. And if we don't get him out, God help us all. Well, I think there's a lot of truth in that. You can, I think you can just go to impeach.com. Again, I'm not selling anything, so I don't get anything out of you going to my website. But if you go to my website, Peter Werbe, W-E-R-B-E.com, it links you to impeachment efforts. Also, come out to these events. Come out to these events. These weak-willed senators and congressmen, with the exception of a few in the Democrats, they're just hopeless dopes, and they're not. But if they saw thousands at events where there's usually only hundreds, and hundreds of thousands where there was only thousands, and millions, I mean, look at Ukraine, look at Bolivia. Those people know how to get rid of presidents, and they didn't do anything violent. They got out on the street, and it was so overwhelming, the opposition to the reigning politicians. And now, and I think Justin from Ann Arbor was correct, I did hear that Cheney's popularity is around 18%. Well, 82% of us think he ought to get out, go back to Texas. You know, he doesn't live in Wyoming, really. Let me see. I think we had one more. I don't even understand this, and I will plead ignorance on it. Mark writes into calltalkyes@yahoo.com. I wouldn't give too much credit to what comes out of John Murtha's mouth. He's a gentleman responsible for the Somalia debacle, which Bush 1 left for Clinton, right, in 1991. Bush is more concerned about, I'm sorry, in 1993. When the hell? I'm losing it. 1993. Bush is more concerned about Iran due to their determination to destroy Israel. I wish Bush was concerned about the United States. All right, I don't have any comment on that because I don't know the connection there. Just one more, maybe. Bob writes in to Call Talk. Yes, if you believe Bush orchestrated 9/11, then you believe that Clinton orchestrated the bombing of the Murray Federal Building. It's not Murray. What is it? Bush can barely get through a speech without stumbling, and you can believe he orchestrated 9/11? I don't think so. Conspiracy theories are intriguing, but we've got to be realistic. I agree. The scandals are all on the front page of the daily newspapers. All right, let's see here. Here's Al. Al's listening at Inkster. Al, hi, you're on the air.
Sir, I was glad to hear you mention earlier about the history of Iran.
Yeah.
Because it proves another lie that Bush says when he says we want to export democracy to the Middle East.
Yeah, we never did. We export our tax dollars to the Middle East. We give it to Egypt.
Can you name the first democracy in the Middle East?
Israel?
No, Iran.
Oh, that's right.
Iran had a popularly elected parliament, a popularly elected prime minister, a guy named Mossadegh, who got into a squabble with Britain over their oil and nationalized the oil. Britain wasn't paying enough, he felt.
Well, he didn't even nationalize it. He was threatening to nationalize it.
He actually did nationalize it.
Okay, go ahead.
And
so he was out of that.
Britain came to Harry S. Truman and asked him to help overthrow it, and Harry S. Truman said no. And when Harry S. Truman went out of office, they came to Eisenhower, and Eisenhower said, go for it. And a guy named Kermit Roosevelt went over there and overthrew Mossadegh and installed the Shah.
Yeah, this torture state that everybody threw Jimmy Carter. I mean, Jimmy Carter gets too free a pass as far as I'm concerned. Complimented Iran, and which was a police torture state that was supplied with American tax dollars through the 50s and 60s and 70s. And that's why these guys now are saying death to America. You know, we just think that these kind of these monsters pop out of the gates of hell, right?
No, there's a really good book by a guy named Stephen Kinzer. He was the New York Times correspondent from Central America called All Shaw's Men.
Yeah, yeah.
And he details the history of the overthrow.
Kinzer's good, very good.
If you could interview him, I'd like to hear that interview.
Well, I have before. Oh, wait a minute, Kinzer. I don't know if I've done Kinzer. There was somebody else. I can't remember. Wasn't it David... Joan Baez's husband that actually went to jail in the 60s for draft evasion. Anyways, I'm just mumbling here. Not good for radio. All right, thanks a lot, Al. Appreciate it. Thanks for staying with us. John in Ann Arbor, welcome to the broadcast.
Hi.
Hi.
How you doing, Peter?
Doing good, thanks.
Sorry, I couldn't tell if you were talking to me or not at first. I just had a couple things to say, I guess. I was calling a different talk show a few days ago, and I had mentioned that I believe terrorism isn't much different than crime, if not a lot weaker than crime, because terrorism only kills a few thousand people a year, if that. And, well, if you look just at drunk driving kills 50,000 people a year in America alone. And if you look at murders, that's another 100,000. And
wait. I mean, John, I got to tell you, your figures for those are way inflated. For one thing, the overall traffic death toll, I think, is down to about 35,000. And there's no way in the world that 100% of that is from drunks. And what was the other figure from? What did you just say?
I was talking about murders, I believe.
Murders, yeah. Murders, yeah. Anyways, but the point is...
My point is just that, why have we spent, if you look at Iraq, we spent about $100 billion a year. If you look at increased spending on Homeland Security, it's in how many tens or hundreds of billions. And then, you look at just good old homegrown crime, which we haven't completely addressed, it's almost forgotten about. I remember that was a big ticket item for politics in the 90s was crime.
Sure. Well, John, that the big right-wing bugaboo is what they call socialism, with government programs taking the populace's money through confiscation, taxes, unwilling, involuntary taxation, and using it for its purposes. Well, that's exactly what is being done with this swollen military budget, this swollen Homeland Security budget, and a number of the other things that you said. And it's sort of a, what would you call it, sort of a national, since it's right wing, sort of a national socialism, eh?
Or, well, that would be the Nazis.
Oh, God. I didn't think about that.
Right. Yeah. I apologize for inflating the figures. I think 50,000 is alcohol-related deaths. And I guess that speaks to my second point, and I'll be really quick, but we need to be accurate.
Yeah.
And my first point almost undermined my second point, but we need to be accurate in what we're talking about, and that goes for the liberals and the libertarians and whoever else too.
Sure, sure.
Because whenever, the right wing is on us, and Fox News is on us, as indicated by that Colorado incident or whatever, as soon as somebody, some extremist says something that might be a little off or might be taken the wrong way, we're all of a sudden seen as the extremists or whatever else. So I just...
Well, I know what you mean. The extremists calling... I mean, Bush is an extremist. Bush is a right-wing extremist. That's who's in power. The far right wing of the United States has captured, through hook and by crook, the institutions of government. And that's why we're experiencing what we are. And we're kind of asleep at the switch. And we got to wake up. All right, John, thanks. Thanks for joining us. Open lines at 313-298-WRIF. Here's Justin in Pinckney. Justin, hi. You're on the air.
How you doing?
Doing great.
That's good. I was just calling in because of the Bush talk you're having.
Uh-huh.
And I was just feeling that, it's mostly liberals calling in, and I was just talking about, all the liberals that are subscribing to the fear we're having in Iraq, and we're spending all these tax dollars and everything. And, I mean, nowadays, it's more that just everybody wants to be a part of something other than be against it. You know, they want to be more towards the fact that the problem is at hand.
Yeah.
And I mean, I'm pro Bush. You know, I voted for him.
What's the matter with you, Justin?
Well, I mean, there's nothing the matter with me. I mean, I'm a Republican. You know, I vote on the Republican side.
What now? Here's a guy that I mean, his popularity is down so that there's only, I mean, he's low as like 34%. And I've been in a minority before, so I mean that on the face of it shouldn't bother you. But everything that this guy's been exposed doing or not, either doing or not doing, Iraq and Katrina and 9/11 and the economy, doesn't any of that bother you?
Well, I mean, some of it bothers me, but I have no reason to blame it on the government. I have no reason to blame some kind of natural disaster as Katrina against the government.
You don't think that there's a little preparation issue that's like been shown on television recently?
But that was going on during the Clinton administration also. I mean, Clinton knew those levees were going to fail during Katrina.
Well, unfortunately, and so what are you saying, that Bush is as bad as Clinton?
Oh, no, I'm not saying Bush is as bad as Clinton.
He said he did the same thing. All right, well, the point being is, when it happens on your watch, you're responsible. You can't hand it off in terms of responsibility to a guy that hasn't been president in 6 years. I mean, where does the buck stop? I mean, Harry Truman's famous thing, the buck stops here. All right, thank you. Appreciate it. You've got some fortitude, I got to say. All right, we'll be right back.
This is WRIF.com.
Right on, you rock.
Here at 1 minute on the Riff.
Buy it the next at WRIF.com. Just 99 cents gets you the tunes you love for your very own. Download it right to your PC.
Your Riff Rock. Online at WRIF.com.
I like it.
Everything that rocks. Rocks.
You're listening to WRIF.com.
back with more Night Call on 101 WRIF Detroit. Here's Peter Werby.
All right, thank you very much, and welcome back at 1 a.m. Let me see, it's about 27 minutes from now. I'll be airing an interview with John Clark of Loyola University in New Orleans, talking about his experiences there and what things are like now. There was a caller that I was batting around how many people died as a result of motor vehicle accidents involving alcohol. And this is an extraordinary list that Steve sent into calltalkyes@yahoo.com. It's from the Journal of American Medical Association from about a year ago. The overwhelming killer, of course, is tobacco. 435,000 deaths. Way down at the bottom is illicit use of drugs, 17,000. That's almost like a footnote. I mean, 17,000 is a lot of people. And let's see. Poor diet and physical inactivity, 400,000. Alcohol consumption, 85,000 deaths, including 16,653 from alcohol-related vehicle crashes. So that's 16,653 from alcohol-related accidents. Motor vehicle accidents in general, actually, our caller was closer. It was about split the difference. He said 50,000. I said 35,000. It's 43,000. So actually, he was 1,000 closer. Bunch of other stuff. Incidents involving firearms, 29,000. Wow, that's a lot. Sexual behaviors. STDs, hepatitis B and C, cervical cancer caused from sexual activity. 20,000. That's good. It's not real. I mean, it's bad. Now, listen, I can take anything that you send me. And here's somebody that at least tried to, sort of a diatribe, a denunciation of me. Who's it from? CD, we'll call him. Except that when you write one huge paragraph, I mean, I can't even get my eyeballs around this. Listen to your show on the way home, have to laugh a bit. How does it feel to be so irrelevant? You know, people used to say that to me, these right-wingers, the few of them that are left. He says, you harp on Iraq war, corporate greed, Katrina response, port security. I forgot about port security. And the latest of the India agreement. Well, how about it? Well, what am I supposed to do? I mean, if you're listening, CD, write back, and I mean, he's telling me this is all just boring and stupid, and Democrats never grew up. It's hard to focus on all this, but more paragraphs, CD. But give me an idea. You're my producer. Write in to call talk. Well, you know, you wrote into the wrong one. calltalkyes@yahoo.com. And tell me if you are going to put forth a program, a call-in talk show, that you wouldn't laugh at and you wouldn't say the mean things that you're saying. What would it look like? So I wouldn't be harping on Bush Co. and all that. How does it feel to be so irrelevant? Well, people used to say that 2, 3, 4 years ago when we, as the American people, didn't reject Bush by two-thirds. We didn't reject Cheney by 80%. We didn't reject the Iraq war. We didn't condemn the government's behavior, the Bush government's behavior about Katrina and all that, on and on. Well, then you say, yeah, I'm irrelevant. Well, now my views are completely relevant because the vast majority, pardon me, the vast majority of American people support it. Let's see. Mary, I think sometimes people use other people's, but I think it was Mary, said, below are the actual voting records of various Arab nations, which are recorded by both the State Department. Here's all our money goes. I forgot about all our money goes to Kuwait, Qatar, Morocco, United Arab Emirates. United Arab Emirates, remember? Yeah, they're the folks that are trying to get this control of our ports. United Arab Emirates votes against the United States in the United Nations 70% of the time. Saudi Arabia, who we also lavish money on, our tax dollars, instead of spending it here in the United States, they vote against this 73%, and just on and on. Pakistan, we were just there, our buddies, this little police state that's about a hair's breadth away from becoming an Islamic state under the control of Al-Qaeda or the Taliban, they vote against this 75% of the time. And he says, U.S. foreign aid, Egypt, for example, after voting 79% of the time against the United States, still receives $2 billion annually in U.S. foreign aid. Think about our country and what it could use. So every 10 years, we are dumping $200 billion of our tax dollars on Egypt, and they vote against us 80% of the time. That's sweet. Well, why is that? It's because it works, ultimately, for the big shots. All right, we've got some open lines. In fact, you guys are falling off. And so either give me a call at 313-298-WRIF, or I shall make a 20-minute speech, which I love to do, and probably you don't want to hear. Here's Mike. Mike's in Fowlerville. Mike, hi, it's Peter Werbe. You're on the air.
Hi, sir. Thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
I listened to you a couple weeks ago, and it stuck with me when you were saying how the Muslims hated the United States because of our support of Israel. I was just wondering if you think we shouldn't support Israel, or if we should cut all ties with Israel.
Well, I don't think we should be giving any aid to countries in the Middle East, period. We've got enough wrong here. I mean, for one thing, Bush is like cutting back on veterans benefits, the proposal is in the new budget, in order to balance the budget. If we stop giving foreign aid, which is almost exclusively military aid, so we've armed everybody in that region to the teeth. I said that there is great hatred fomented in the Arab world and the Muslim world across the world, including non-Arab states, because of our support for Israel when it refuses to alter its policies against the Palestinians. The United States has a capacity to make peace. It always has in the Middle East and carry out things like nuclear disarmament and what have you. But the policies around war and these regional disputes ultimately work to the benefit of this huge, what Eisenhower called the military-industrial complex. So almost everyone is a chip in the game if you're not in the first world, if you're not France or Britain or Canada or something like that. So the aid to Israel isn't a matter, should we not give aid to Israel. It's a matter of this has been a catastrophic failure for the people of that region, and it's been a looting of the American taxpayer for the last 50 years, and it works to the benefit of the industrial and financial elite of this country.
I understand what you're saying, but I think you're revising history just a little bit, because we were at war with the United Soviet Socialist Republic for close to 50 years, and Israel was basically our only friend in the Middle East.
That's not true at all.
Well, the other guys, they were our friends as long as we paid them, but Israel was our true friend, and they were the only democracy in the Middle East most of the time.
Well, it wasn't until, as the one caller said, until the United States overthrew one of them in Iran, which set the stage for what's going on now. Well, I mean, the United States was giving Israel billions of dollars, just like Iran was our ally under this police torture state that the United States installed, and because we paid them off as well.
Peter, we had to do a lot of bad things things that were cut close to the cloth in order to defeat Russia.
I don't think that's true. I mean, maybe that was the Soviet Union never represented a threat to the United States. It never represented a threat to Western Europe. This was the Cold War was mostly contrived. I mean, once it got into operation, sure. I mean, if you pick a fight, you usually get one. The Soviet Union under Stalin wanted to continue the wartime alliances. The United States, which had gone onto a permanent war economy, which is the only thing that got us out of got us out of the Great Depression of the 30s, needed another enemy to justify these enormous war expenditures and decided that the Soviet Union was our world enemy. Let me repeat again. The Cold War was mostly manufactured by the West.
Peter, that's ridiculous.
Well, I mean, you can't say it's ridiculous, and you have to have some supporting evidence. Stalin had a conservative empire, this monstrous bureaucratic police state that had the glory of defeating the Nazis in World War II, and was, I mean, primarily overwhelmingly responsible for defeating Nazism and in Europe, and had been invaded by the West three times in 150 years, and wanted the spoils of war, because this wasn't a war about democracy. It wasn't a war, Second World War. It wasn't a war about freedom. It was an inter-imperial war, and the United States actually was facing, for once, enemies worse than them, in the form of Japan and Nazi Germany. But it wasn't never about democracy or anything like that. It was about in the Pacific. It was about control of China. That's why the Japanese bombed Pearl Harbor. And in Europe, it was, again, about which empire was going to expand which way.
Exactly. I agree with you on that.
Okay.
But on the other hand, Russia, there is no doubt in my mind, if the United States wouldn't have the military, Russia would have taken over the rest of the world. They would have said it started with Europe.
Well, I mean, that was the prevailing myth. This is what was said. But if you can, they have all the Russian archives. They're all open. There were no plans for the invasion of Western Europe. There were no plans for the invasion of the United States. The United States had plans on the drawing boards for invasion and occupation of the Soviet Union. Stalin would have been more than happy. I mean, whenever there were like revolutionary occurrences, they would barely support him. I mean, the North Vietnamese, all during the 1960s, complained bitterly that they could not get out of the Soviet Union advanced weaponry that they needed to to shoot down U.S. planes and what have you.
Now, Peter, I want to bring up one more real quick point, because I'm big pro-military.
Yeah.
And you say we should cut the military budget in by three quarters, I think I heard you say last week.
I'll up it one. I'll call it 80%, yeah.
Now, you don't think North Korea, if we weren't around, North Korea wouldn't invade South Korea and then go into Cambodia and Vietnam?
Well, I'll tell you. The world is on a knife's edge now, and it's because of these failed military policies that go back 50 years or more, 60 years now. And I'm not saying that we say, okay, we're dropping all of our defenses, and we're disbanding our army, and we're decommissioning our nukes, and we're not going to have bases all over the world beginning next Saturday. I mean, that could create the kind of instability that you said, but that I agree. But there are ways that I think that this world could begin to live in peace, and we're continuing the same policies of preparation for war that have always ended in war.
But don't you think that the extremist jihad would kill Americans if they could?
Well, yeah, but there's not that many of them. They're they got lucky on September 11th. Usually they were killing, they would kill people like some of those buildings in Africa, a few hundred. I mean, it was just that, I don't know what to say. I mean, our military doesn't work against Star Wars and advanced missile systems and all that. Don't work against guys that are willing to fly planes into buildings. That's the terrorism has nothing to do with the military budget. That has to do with intelligence, police work, and most foremost of all is reducing the issues. I mean, here is this monstrous genius, this evil genius of Osama bin Laden, and what does he say? He says, get out of the Middle East, get out of Saudi Arabia, get out of Iraq. Wow. That's what is some of his main things that he's pissed off about. And why would we be hurt? I mean, he's like, God, we're not going to give in to this monster that inflicted such a hideous attack on us. But if we wouldn't be there 6,000 miles from our own damn home, a lot of this wouldn't have occurred in the first place.
Yeah, but why does he want us out? He wants us out so he can build his own empire, empire.
Yeah, but that'd be like you or me wanting to build our own empire. He doesn't have any capacity for that. Do me a favor. Mike, just give me a last word, and I'm going to go on to somebody else.
Okay. I like George Bush because he's a normal, straight guy.
Ugh.
He's not the smartest man in the world, but at least he's a normal man.
Okay. All right. Okay. All right. George Bush is normal. All right. I said I'd let him have the last word. All right. Here's Dan from Troy. Dan, hi. You're on the air.
Hi, Peter. How's it going?
Going great.
Just a couple points I'd like to make. Beginning with what the last caller just stated, that, you know, Bush is a great man and things like this. You know, that he's not the smartest man. He's the type of person you want to meet at a party, not someone you really want to be in the position that he's in.
Yeah, how can you, don't you want the smartest guy in the world?
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. I mean, people go after Clinton, people go after Gore, saying, oh, Gore invented the internet. But look, I mean, look at what Bush has done. I mean, there's so many, I mean, every week there's something new.
Uh-huh.
You know, you'd realize, you'd think that people would realize and wake up that, you know, this is not the way a country should be run. I'd hate to put it this way, but he's apparently anti-American in the business deals he's conducting.
Well,
I mean, the way the economy is, the way everything happens, I mean, it just seems to fall into place that we're going straight into a depression.
Well, let me say this, that these guys are, you know, they fly all these flags and they run all this patriotic crap, and they're complete internationalists on a business level. I mean, I agree with internationalism and on you know, some of its main tenets, but these guys, they don't have any allegiance to the United States other than it's another way to manipulate the rubes. Wait a minute. Oh, I'm sorry. I had your thing down. Yeah.
Oh.
Yeah, go ahead.
Well, just the other thing was you had an email from a person by the name of CD who asks, you know, what kind of talk show that, you know, you'd like to see him present to you.
Uh-huh.
And I got a feeling it'd be something along the lines of the O'Reilly factor, you know, where he tries to push everything behind him, saying, oh, well, it's not our fault, it's not our fault. And he's trying to dig deeper into somewhere else to pull a scapegoat out, you know.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I've listened to his show, and it's, you know, I can't believe that people believe what he says. I mean, I'm not a Republican, I'm not a Democrat, but, you know, I mean, I vote for who can do the job the best, and the last few years it's been the Democrats because the Republicans can't seem to step up to the plate properly. You know, in the fashion they conduct themselves, you know, it makes you wonder how people can still follow them.
Well, it does to me as well. All right, Dan, thank you very much. I appreciate your call. Now, and I knew this was happening. Steve writes into calltalkyes@yahoo.com. He says, you haven't mentioned the hottest topic, another smoking gun. Bush got caught in another big lie. The mantra from the Bush administration for the past 6 months has been that no one expected nor could have adequately prepared for a hurricane of Katrina's devastation. Specifically, 4 days after Katrina struck the coast, Bush, during an interview on ABC's Good Morning America, said, I don't think anybody could have anticipated the breach of the levees. And now we know, of course, that they did. Well, thanks, Steve. But in about 11 minutes, we're going to be taking that up. So stay tuned for that. Paul writes into Call Talk Yes at Yahoo. Republican, Democrat, they're interchangeable. When Bush looks the other way regarding the Dubai acquisition of the U.S. ports, and Bill Clinton advises the Dubai company on how to overcome American opposition to its purchase, and the U.S. representatives appear shocked by this news, then we're all doomed. Anyone up for a revolution? Says Paul. Okay, you can count me in on that. You say you want a revolution. All right. My wife says, never sing in public, Pete. Here's Dean and Ida. Dean Hyde. It's Peter Werby. You're on the air.
Hi, how you doing?
Doing good.
I've been spending all evening trying to get to your program on the internet, and I finally got there about 5 minutes or so ago.
Well, good.
Didn't hear too much, except you were talking a little bit about Russia. And there's something I thought was interesting about Russia. It seems like all their power and everything, their military threat and everything else, just kind of dried up when the grain ministers from Russia no longer came to the U.S.
When the grain ministers?
Yeah, are you familiar with the grain ministers?
Tell me.
Well, we haven't heard anything about them since Russia dried up.
Uh-huh.
But before that, every year you would see an announcement that the Russian grain ministers are coming over here to the U.S.
No, to buy grain.
And basically they got grain at about 15 cents a bushel less than what American farmers were paid with subsidies.
Right.
And they take it to the European market instead of feeding their starving masses and dump it on the European market. They could underprice us, and then they took the money and built a big military.
Yeah, it was all kind of a racket.
It was kind of an interesting way of financing them, and yet I've never heard anybody really comment on the grain ministers.
Yeah. Yeah, no, that's interesting. I don't know much about it. I will take a look. Thanks, Dean. Thanks for tipping me off. Hey, by the way, I was just reading this book called The Myth of the Great War, and which I was I mean, I knew a lot of this before, but I was just shocked at what occurred during World War II. Absolutely shocked, because this is the one good war, right? Well, none of them are good. None of them are good at all. But you should be able to Google it, The Myth of the Great War. And it's a guy whose name, I'm reading a book, I can't remember the author, it begins with K. I think that's the deal. Chris from Ann Arbor, it's Peter Werbe, you're on the air.
Hey, Peter, I just want to talk a little about the Iraq civilian war statistics.
Sure.
We've been talking about those, you know, our sort of domestic death tolls. And I did a little bit of research back in, I think it was December, when Bush came out and said about the 30,000 civilian deaths in Iraq.
Right.
Which I think is kind of a conservative number in itself, but I sort of explored those numbers, and the exact numbers are on my website, which is whowantsarevolution.com. And
did you just write that email to me?
No, I didn't actually, which is kind of interesting.
Oh, okay.
But, yeah, and it came out to be about 120,000 people if you use the percentage of their country to our country.
Uh-huh.
So that it would be like us losing the entire population of Ann Arbor or Knoxville, Tennessee in a war, which I thought was amazing, because we lost, you know, maybe a few thousand people in the war on terror, you know, but the Iraqis have paid a much dearer cost than we have, and we don't even really think twice about it. You know, we just keep pushing more and more money into it when really we haven't even paid the greatest cost, you know, that they've paid.
I know, and I think there's a lot of figures that show the Iraqi civilian deaths, that's at the hands of the U.S. military, is over 100,000, because you know, we got to break a few eggs to make an omelet, except the omelet isn't holding together. Chris, do me a favor, because I don't, I got too much junk on the console here. Email me at calltalkyes@yahoo.com and email your site to me, okay?
Okay.
All right, thanks a lot. Thanks for joining us. Let me see if I can get a. Time is okay. We got one more call. All right, here. It's Chris from Altamont. You're on the air.
Altamont, yeah. How you doing, Peter?
Doing good.
I read a couple weeks ago in the Detroit News and the Free Press, and I actually heard it on the news, that ExxonMobil cleared $10 billion last year.
Profit, yeah. Yeah.
Isn't that nice?
Yeah, yeah. So how
can we pay these outrageous gas prices? All of Bush's buddies are getting fat.
And we're getting robbed.
It's disgusting.
Yeah, absolutely. It's absolutely disgusting. And, I mean, they see how much of a fuss we put up. And as you see, because of a number of occurrences in oil-producing countries, Nigeria and Saudi Arabia, I mean, there was a threat of a terrorist attack, or one that was foiled. And that sent the price of gas, of oil up. And you know that we're being ripped off by ExxonMobil and Chevron and these other countries, companies rather, because they, if their costs kept coming, if the price was consistent with their costs, they would make the same profit. But the fact that they're making record profits means what? That we're being ripped off. We're being ripped off big time. And Bush has said publicly, I support this, because there are two kinds of people. One is the populist, which supports the right and power of the people, and the other is the corporatist, which Bush Co. is comprised of. And another word for a corporatist is what? Yeah, a fascist. All right, thanks a lot. All right, stay tuned. A report from New Orleans as it is today, right after these. Thanks for listening. Thanks for calling.
You're listening to WRIF.com.
Think you have what it takes to be the next Riff Rock Girl? 101 WRIF and the Tri-County Pontiac GMC dealers, along with MGM Grand Detroit Casino, are looking for one very special woman to be the 2006 Riff Rock Girl. Think you can handle a $30,000 year-long contract? How about your choice of a new Pontiac or GMC? A Riff ad, Inside Stuff magazine? Oh yeah, and you'll be a star in a Riff TV commercial. Go ahead and mark it in your day planner now. The first casting call to find the Riff Rock Girl will be at March 4th between 3 p.m. and 7 p.m. at GameWorks inside Great Lakes Crossing in Auburn Hills. If you're 21 or older, bring your bio and a photo of yourself to one of the RIF's three auditions. For more details and official rules, visit WRIF.com. Are you the next RIF Rock Girl? The 2006 RIF Rock Girl Search. Presented by Tri-County Pontiac GMC Dealers. Also brought to you in part by MGM Grand Detroit Casino, where the city shines. And 101 WRIF. Everything.
Rocks.
This
is WRIF.com.
On 101WRIF Detroit, here's your host, Peter Werby.
Thank you very much for joining me. If you've been aware of the news this week, you know that there's new videos out showing that that the whole Bush administration was warned before Katrina hit, before it slammed into the Gulf Coast, contrary to the remarks that were made following it and the absolute incompetent and unprepared way the administration dealt with this huge natural disaster, which then turned out to be a man-made disaster as well. Joining me from New Orleans is John Clark. John Clark is professor of philosophy at Loyola University in New Orleans. He chairs the Department of Humanities in City College, and he teaches in the Loyola Environmental Studies programs, and he lives in the Carrollton neighborhood of Uptown New Orleans and on Bayou La Terre in Hancock County, Mississippi. He's been active for years in the green movement and also works in the bioregional movement and in ecological forestry, and currently is reforesting and introducing native species on an 83-acre tract along Bayou La Terre in Hancock County, Mississippi. John Clark, welcome to the Peter Werby Show.
Hello, Peter. I'm very happy to be with you.
Well, thank you. And your story, along with everyone else who is a native of New Orleans, is just extraordinary. And I found out that contrary to like other friends of mine, like for instance, Andre Codrescu, you didn't arrive in the last 20 years or so. Your family goes way back into New Orleans history, doesn't it?
That's right. We've been here since the beginning. We've been here 13 generations. My first ancestor came to Louisiana in the first 3 years, we know, before the first census. And we also know that he was a prisoner who was sentenced to come to Louisiana, which I'm very proud of. apparently somebody who didn't pay taxes on the products he was selling, got in trouble with the king.
Is this French now?
French, yeah. Oh. The French branch of the family goes back. So I like to think of my first ancestor as a tax resister.
And what year was this now?
Well, it was before 1721, because that was the first census. We haven't pinned it down, but the city started in 1718, and a lot of the early settlers were people who were sent here by the king, because it was not a place that people in their right mind would want to go, given our the fact that it's a swamp. We had yellow fever. We had a lot of problems, including flooding, which is a problem we've had ever since.
John Clark, so many people I've spoken to and I've heard speak about that fateful day 6 months ago when Katrina hit, remember exactly where they were in New Orleans. Now, here you are, a person and a family that goes back generations upon generations, and you were watching Katrina hit from far, far away. I wonder if you could tell us about that and what the reaction was being so far from home.
It was a very horrifying period. I was in India. I was doing volunteer work with a group called the LHA, Louisiana Himalaya Association, which works with Tibetan refugees in upper Dharamsala, India, which is the largest center of the refugee Tibetan community. It's a very ironic situation in many ways. I went to India to work with people who had lost their country and were refugees, and while I was there, I found that my own city had become a city of refugees. We heard the weekend before the hurricane that a very large major hurricane was heading in our direction. I, with great difficulty, got through to one or two people in the family, and really heard a kind of panicked mentality that was going on a day or two before the hurricane. The day of the hurricane, actually the Tibetan monks had a puja, a ceremony for New Orleans.
Really?
In which 20 monks sat in a circle at the LHA center where we were doing our work and did chanting and thinking about New Orleans. And later that day, we heard that the hurricane missed the city, and we felt very relieved. But
yeah.
Then, to our great horror, shortly thereafter, we began to see reports on the BBC that the city had been flooded, and we began to see pictures of people on rooftops, signs that people had made saying, help, we have no water, we have no food, I have a medical condition, et cetera. We saw images of the looting, the desperate condition of people at the convention center and the Superdome. In fact, I didn't know it, but at one point, one of my children was at the convention center.
No.
He ended up being missing for about 2.5 weeks. So while I was in India, I was trying to cope with the fact that one of my children was missing. I didn't know exactly what happened to all of my family and our houses. Later, I found out that a number of people in the family had been flooded. My daughter, for instance, lost everything, and her family had to go to Austin for a year. So it was a very difficult time, to say the least.
Well, I can imagine when you were in India. Here you were out of harm's way, but I suspect you. I suspect that you wish you had been back there at the time.
Right, I regretted very much not being in the city. I had never evacuated for a hurricane, and I wanted to come back as quickly as possible. In one way, I was very fortunate if I was going to be away to be where I was, because I was with Tibetans who have suffered a great deal and in spite of it all, have a way of life that sustains them very well. They have meditative practices and practices of everyday life that helps them tremendously. So I was in a cultural atmosphere that really helped me as much as anything possibly could, to prepare for coming back. Also, the electricity goes off frequently. You lose water. People live at a very subsistence level in many ways. So I was, for a month anyway, I was experiencing some of the things that I was going to experience when I came back to New Orleans, although not quite on the same scale.
John Clark, when you arrived back in New Orleans, you had seen these images on television. So were you prepared for it, or was actually being there that much more horrific?
There's absolutely no way to prepare for it.
Yeah.
I flew back to Louisiana on the 16th of September, so I was actually in the city on the 18th, and it was certainly like nothing I've ever experienced in my life. At times I felt like I was in some strange Hollywood movie. You may have seen some of these films in which people end up being the last person alive.
Sure.
I could drive down major boulevards and not confront another vehicle in 2 or 3 miles. The city was, of course, devastated. Trees were down everywhere. Buildings had collapsed in some cases. Debris was everywhere. So it was a very overpowering kind of experience to be in the midst of that kind of devastation. And the city by that time was relatively empty. I later found out there were many more people than I thought. The same day that I got back, I got in touch with a friend who lives in an area called the Ninth Ward, which was one of the hardest hit areas, although not her neighborhood directly. And I linked up with a volunteer group that was doing relief aid. And that's really what got me through the initial period of coming back. I spent my first week living at her house with the group, which used the name Common Ground, which is actually the name of a larger relief organization. And the little group in her neighborhood was inspired by Common Ground, so they took the same name. So I actually lived there, slept there, ate meals with people there, and helped cook, distribute food, deliver food in my truck, and do other work. So being with people who were trying to help their neighbors, or in the larger sense, their neighbors, because many of them had already come from other states, this experience really sustained me in this period of tremendous grief and horror when I saw the city.
You listen to the Peter Werbe Show. My guest is John Clark. He's a professor of philosophy at Loyola University, New Orleans, and he's a resident of that city. You know, John, a number of us here in the Detroit area got together and we raised money and didn't give it to the Red Cross or whatever else was soliciting, but to this Common Ground organization and also Food Not Bombs. And I think it's almost unfortunately legendary, the failure of FEMA, and still is 6 months later, to take care of the people that were hurt so badly for this occurrence. Tell us a little about the self-initiative that people took, like Common Ground and the role of groups like Food Not Bombs.
Yeah, I worked with Food Not Bombs. That was one of the groups that was in our neighborhood organization at that time. And later on, I got more involved with Common Ground and also another group called the Soul Patrol in the 7th Ward of New Orleans, which was inspired by a neighborhood leader named Mama D, who has become somewhat legendary. It's been a wonderful experience seeing what is possible at the grassroots level. The failure of the established institutions was, to say the least, very, very striking at that time. I saw a lot of Red Cross people when I was trying to get back to New Orleans at the airport in Houston, at the airport in Lafayette, Louisiana. But when I got back to New Orleans, I didn't see them anywhere. The official policy was to get people out of New Orleans, if necessary, to arrest them and take them out of New Orleans, including people who were doing grassroots relief work. There was a lot of harassment by the police and some members of the military of local relief workers. On the other hand, the work was done. Before any other medical aid was really coming into New Orleans, Common Ground had already established a clinic in the Algiers neighborhood on the west bank of New Orleans, west bank of the Mississippi. Right now, just to jump a little bit into the present, because this has been building up over the 6 months.
John, I was just going to say, let me just interrupt you, because I wanted to just ask you before we come to the present, and I want you to continue.
I'm sorry.
No, that's fine. I was being rude, interrupting you. But I was going to say, is there a contradiction between being critical of the federal and state government for not being prepared enough to provide what these self-initiatives did, and on the other hand, celebrating the work of groups like Common Ground and Food Not Bombs and Soul Patrol? I mean, if the government would have done what most people think they should have, there wouldn't have been a necessity for this this self-initiative.
Well, I don't entirely agree with that analysis. I think there are two issues here. One is the responsibilities of the government, or the responsibilities that the government claims to have, and its failure to carry out those responsibilities. And then there's another question of what the government is capable of doing in any case. And I think groups like Common Ground and the Soul Patrol and other local groups are doing far more than any government agencies could ever do, and have a vision that goes far beyond anything that government bureaucracies or administrators could possibly have. To go back to the first part of that, the government certainly failed, I think, far beyond the worst fears of anyone. I went up to New York to testify at something called the Bush Tribunal, which was mainly about the war in Iraq, but it was also about Katrina. And in my testimony there, I talked about the triple crime of Katrina on the part of the government, which was the failure to protect the city to begin with. Because I think one thing we have to think about is who bears ultimate responsibility for this catastrophe that we're facing. And it is the federal government. The Corps of Engineers was responsible for building levees that would protect us from the kind of hurricane that didn't hit us, because it passed east of New Orleans. So the first part of the crime was the crime of not protecting us. The second part was the disgraceful lack of response to the desperate needs of tens of thousands of people in the city, who were seen all over the world in a state of absolutely heart rending need that was not taken care of. And then the third part of the crime was the crime of what's going on right now, which I think we should talk about a little bit, about how it really is a kind of ethnic cleansing, and that many people are not being given the help that they need to come back.
Because they don't want them. They don't want them to come back.
Some people do not want most of the people in the city to come back. There's a massive scheme of redevelopment and changing of the fundamental nature of the city. So that's one side of the issue. What the government was supposed to do and what it failed to do and continues to fail to do. The other side is what it might have done even at best, which of course at best it would have prevented the catastrophe, but given the fact that there was a catastrophe, it could only do a certain amount to help people. The grassroots organizations have a vision that goes far beyond just doing some of the good work that we immediately need, which is, for instance, giving people food in some cases when they come back, putting tarps on their roof so that rainwater doesn't get in, and doing some of the things that are absolutely necessary right now. A group like Common Ground has as part of its vision creating much better, stronger, self-reliant communities than we've ever had. For instance, through worker cooperatives, which would create jobs on the grassroots level, expanding community gardens, producing more of our own food, producing more cooperative, mutual aid kind of organizations in the neighborhood, and in effect, making our communities much stronger than they've ever been before.
Mm-hmm.
And this is what I see as one of the great things, one of the very wonderful things that is coming out of this disaster.
Well, John Clark, what is the situation now? I kind of, maybe you did can pick up the thread, I think you did, of the present. But we see, and they are, it was being marked as we do so frequently by the six-month anniversary of Katrina, and we hear that you know, there's huge piles of debris everywhere still, that friends of mine and yours were just visiting there, and they said they were just stunned by what New Orleans still looks like.
Well, it's very striking if you come here now and haven't been here. I mean, there really is no comparison between the debris in the streets now and what was here 6 months or 3 months ago. But it's still very bad. What disturbs me most is not the debris in the streets, but the debris in people's houses, because a large percentage of it has never been taken out. You can still see all people's possessions, devastated possessions lying. You know, if you look in doorways, sometimes whole walls are down, and you see everything that people had just sitting there rotting, mold-covered. In fact, I took our friends to visit my daughter's house during their visit, and her neighborhood was one of the worst hit, the Lakeview neighborhood, and probably most of the houses in the city are in that condition, which means that the debris has not been taken out yet and put on the street to be picked up. The houses have not been gutted. The houses are not ready even to be renovated, and it will be a long time before anybody can get back into them. The highest figure I've heard about the current population of New Orleans is that 40% may be back. Very recently, I was hearing 20% or 30% at the most, but I think everybody agrees most people are not back, and a large percentage of them will have great difficulty coming back.
How is your house affected?
I did rather well. One thing that people are learning a lot more about is the geography of the city in a very precise way, down to the exact elevation above sea level. Originally, New Orleans was built on the natural levees of the Mississippi and on several of what we call ridges, which means an area that is above sea level, called the Esplanade Ridge, the Gentilly Ridge, and the Metairie Ridge. And my house happens to be on something called the Carrollton Spur, which is a little area, a little peninsula that comes out from the Mississippi River where old crevasses or breaks created a higher area a little bit away from the river. So as it turns out, I have a building in the back of my house, two rooms that were slightly flooded, and I had very bad roof damage, so I've had water coming into the house for the past 6 months to a certain degree. I've patched up the roof, covered it up, and put a kid's swimming pool and a bunch of containers in the attic, and stopped it from actually coming into the house. But I'm still trying to get a roof on my house, basically, is where I stand.
And it's, the contractors just aren't available?
Just a week ago, I finally got approval from the insurance company that they would actually cover new roof.
They haven't been good about that, have they?
No, many of them have been very bad. We have had enormous problems of every sort. One reason why, I'll give you a list of reasons why people have trouble coming back.
Sure.
Most of the hospitals have been closed. The vast majority of the schools have been closed. Most people do not have jobs to come back to. And there hasn't been aid to fix their houses to the point where, or even insurance coverage to the point where they could come back and live in their own homes.
But your university, Loyola, is open because you said you had to teach tonight, right?
Yes. The major universities are all open. They opened in January.
Yeah. Well, what's ahead? I mean, that's such a difficult prediction. We hear all sorts of things. And someone said to me, and I guess it probably occurs to you and everyone else, what's going to be any different this coming hurricane season?
Yeah, that's the problem. We need two things to survive. You know, and I think we have to look at it that way. There is no assurance that this city will survive. People don't like to think about that. We need better levees, and we need wetlands restoration. Our major protection from flooding has been the wetlands that are between us and the Gulf of Mexico. A frequently cited statistic is that for every 2.7 miles of wetlands between us and the coast, 1 foot of storm surge is diminished. In the last hurricane, we lost 50 years of destruction of wetlands in one day.
So
what would have been lost in 50 years was lost in one day.
Oh, I see.
So we are in much worse condition now. So what we need is major levee construction. And for the next year, all we're going to get is the levees that we were supposed to have for the last hurricane that we didn't have. And we need much better levees, and we need wetlands restoration. And there's a very good proposal for a $15 billion wetlands restoration program over a number of years. The Bush administration allocated $250 million, which is about 3% of what we're going to need to restore the wetlands. I like to point out that since the Second World War, the petroleum industry has extracted, believe it or not, 15 billion barrels of oil from Louisiana on the coast. And what we've gotten in return is basically a very poor state. We've lost our hurricane protection because the oil industry has destroyed our coastline. And we've gotten terrible pollution. So I think there's a tremendous question of restorative justice that we need our natural protection from disaster, which has been taken away from us in the pursuit of vast mineral wealth, which others have taken from this state.
Well, John Clark, we're out of time, and we've really only scratched the surface. It just occurred to me that people could do well to go to my site, Peter Werbe, W-E-R-B-E, peterwerbe.com. Click on the left side on the front page of the Fifth Estate magazine, and John Clark has a letter from New Orleans. It's an astounding account that amplifies on what we've talked about here today. John, is there any website that you have or one that you would send people to?
What I will give you right now is the Common Ground Collective website,
okay,
which would be a good start.
What's that?
It's commongroundrelief.org.
Well, thank
one,
you.
One word, commongroundrelief.org.
Well, thank you so much, and I think I made a mistake not taking you and others up on the invitations I had gotten pre-Katrina. Maybe I'll come down your way one of these days.
Please come as soon as possible. And one thing I just have to ask, if I have a few seconds,
sure,
is that anyone who would like to make very good use of their time, vacation time, or any other time, please come down to New Orleans and help. We desperately need help. If you can't do that, please support grassroots organizations like Common Ground.
Thank you, John Clark.
Thank you so much.
This is WRIF.com. And now, a word from the Riff Legal Eagles. Unless otherwise stated, all entrants for WRIF contests must be at least 18 years of age and a legal resident of the United States. A household is eligible to win one contest per 30 days every 6 months for prizes valued at $600 or higher. Radio Media Detroit and its affiliates, promotional sponsors, advertising and promotional agencies, and other radio and television stations in the Detroit ADI are not eligible to participate. One entry per person. No purchase or other consideration is necessary to participate in the contest. Void where prohibited. Prizes are non-transferable or redeemable for cash. 101 WRIF reserves the right to substitute any prize for one of equal or greater value. By participating in the contest, contestants consent to the broadcast and or publication of their name, voice, face, and or likeness without compensation. Participants listening online at www.wrif.com may receive audio that is delayed by as much as 60 seconds later than the over-the-air transmission, which could potentially affect chances of winning. General contest rules are available online at www.wrif.com or during regular business hours at the WRIF Studios, 1 Radio Plaza, Detroit, Michigan, 482-220. You're listening to WRIF.com.
back with more Night Call on 101 WRIF Detroit. Here's Peter Werby.
Thank you very much for joining me. One of the things that I hear from younger people is that fear, and I think a lot of you have heard it before, is that the new generation, the one just coming up, may be the first generation in 150 years or about 200 years that's not going to do better than the generation before it. And it's pretty disturbing. It's disturbing to those of us with children that are concerned about our kids. And it's also concern for young people as well. How are they going to make ends meet and all of that? Addressing this problem is Tamara Drought. She has written a book called Strapped, Why America's 20 and 30-somethings Can't Get Ahead. And Tamara Drought is the director of the Economic Opportunity Program at Demos. Demos is a national think tank headquartered in New York. Tamara Drought is on the road in support of her book right now. Tamara, welcome to the Peter Werby Show.
Thanks for having me.
Where have we reached you? What city?
I'm in Austin.
Okay, Austin, Texas.
Nice and 80 degrees.
Well, it's a little different in Detroit. I think it's about 25 out. This is probably a frightening title, a subtitle particularly, Why America's 20 and 30-somethings Can't Get Ahead. Is there a simple answer or is it a complex, long answer?
How about we shoot for in between?
Okay.
I think it's been typically sold as a simple answer, which is young people just don't know how to budget and they're overspending. One of the reasons I wanted to write the book is that actually there's a lot more going on, and there's a lot more to this story than that. What has really happened, and I think what's happening to young people today, is they're feeling the fallout of a three-decade-long shift in our public policy and the way we structure opportunity in this country. The reality is that all along the way, we as a society have made decisions that have created this obstacle course that young people are on. And it starts at the very beginning from getting an education. At the federal level, we've shifted from grants, which don't have to be repaid, to student loans. The era of sort of cheap state college tuition is over. And then there's a lot of new economic pressures facing today's young people. And those happen when they get ready to get married and they're starting families. And, as a nation, we just haven't caught up to the reality that both parents work in today's society. And there's a real lack of, high-quality, affordable child care out there. We don't have paid family leave, all of which are things that every other industrialized nation in the country now provides as sort of basic supports for families.
Mm-hmm. Now, one of the reasons I think books like yours, Strapped, is so important is because these shifts in the way our economic life is lived doesn't happen real dramatically, like when a depression hits or something like that. So this has kind of been shifted in. I mean, a generation or two ago, let's say two generations ago, I'm trying to do my math here, like 60 years ago, 50 years ago, 40 years ago, the bread earner was typically the male, the woman stayed at home. Now it's almost a necessity for to have a two-family income if you want to have anything approaching a middle-class life. Is that right?
That's right, and I certainly wouldn't argue that we should go back to the public policy of the 1950s, which was basically mom stays home. There are lots of economic and social benefits to moms working, so that should be clear. You know, I think and you're right about it not being a dramatic shift, which is why I wanted to write the book, because I don't think people understand how much the obstacle course to adulthood has changed in a generation. You know, if we just look at what's happened to incomes, if you look at the typical earnings of a 25 to 34-year-old college grad, compare what they're earning today to what they would have earned 30 years ago, and it's either around the same or actually a little less. And then for those without college degrees, they're earning, after adjusting for inflation, $13,000 less per year than they would have a generation ago. So that right there is already one major strike against young people today.
Sure, that's probably a result of deindustrialization and deunionization, I'm sure, with the latter, right, with working class jobs that very frequently in the era that's gone by provided a middle class income for people without college education that weren't white collar.
That's exactly right. And I talk about, I have a whole chapter of policy reform ideas, and I definitely talk about the need to really enforce the labor laws that exist in this country that on paper say that workers have the right to unionize their workplace, but in reality has gotten to be a brutal battle in which, you know, workers are overspent and outgunned and outmaneuvered by their employers. We have got to figure out a way to make the service sector jobs that are replacing those good manufacturing jobs better paying jobs. And it's going to take unions, but it's also going to take, I think, a realization in this country that we're going to have to move toward picking up the tab for things like health care.
My guest is Tamara Drought. She's written Strapped, Why America's 20 and 30-somethings Can't Get Ahead. It's published by Doubleday, and Tamara works with Demos, a think tank. We'll talk a little about her organization and what solutions it has, because pointing out the problem, it's getting to be easier and easier, but solutions harder and harder. Now, let's go back a little to what you said about the perception that one of the reasons that young people are having such a hard time is that they overspend. And there's some truth in that. Obviously, if many young people, which have unprecedented access to credit through credit cards and debit cards and what have you, if they are so mired in debt, they are spending over their income. So but the perception is they're buying iPods and cool clothing and you know, with the label, with huge label on the outside. I thought, never mind, I won't even get into fashion. But in other words, that could both things be happening simultaneously? The young people not living within their means, having the ability to live outside of it. I mean, when I was a kid, you had money, and then when it ran out, there wasn't any more.
Right. Absolutely. I mean, you know, all of America is now actually living beyond its means. For the first time, our debt has exceeded our disposable income. So this is sort of one of those things that we're all guilty of. And I don't think young people are particularly any more guilty of it. You know, one of the things that I mentioned in the book is that this is all we've talked about when we talk about why young people aren't getting ahead. And the reason why I wanted to write the book is not to just totally dismiss that, although I don't give a lot of attention to it in the book because I think we've given too much attention to it, but to say there is these much larger structural political shifts that is really impacting the ability for people to either work or educate their way into the middle class, and we have dropped the ball in terms of our public responsibility to investing in things that ensure that if you work hard, you get ahead. Yes, credit card debt is a huge problem for young people. Some of it is, you know, yes, you know, treating yourself every once in a while to things that you can't afford. But a lot of it is car repairs. It's buying a suit for your first interview. It's paying for health care costs, which are a lot of the same reasons people of all ages are racking up credit card debt.
Now, one of the perceptions as well is that, hey, you're young people. You're not going to be making much money. When I was your age, I was making hardly anything, and I had to live in a so-and-so.
Right.
And now I'm middle-aged, and I'm middle class, and everything's okay. And so it's just part of the process of growing into the economic structure.
Right. If only that were the case, I think that we can no longer bet on the fact that young people are going to age into economic security. One, they start out making less in the labor market to begin with. And then there's actually been studies that show that their earnings don't grow as quickly as they would have a generation ago. And I think the best way to think about this is, you know, 30 years ago when a 25-year-old entered the labor market, they were on an escalator. They could sort of count on a swift but steady progression, increase in their earnings. Today, when a 25-year-old hits the labor market, they're on one of those automated airport walkways.
Hmm.
You know, the economy, totally level, much less increase in their earnings. So we can't just count on that. And the other thing, too, is that we now have this enormous student loan debt burden, $20,000 on average. That doesn't go away overnight. And often there's new pressures to continue on to grad school. All of this is happening when people are getting married and starting families. And then you add in the additional cost burden of a child, which has always existed, but childcare, which is a very expensive, often it's the second highest budget item after the rent or the mortgage. and the financial pressures start over again. So I'm not convinced we're going to age out of this. And, yes, earnings will go up, but because young people are starting out from a much weaker economic position, they're not going to see nearly the gains over time that previous generations did.
Well, also, you're mentioning college. And when I went to college, college was relatively inexpensive. And, I mean, I could make enough for the year working during the summer. And there were some people that had student loans, and they weren't onerous in terms of the total amount. But I was just reading, I'm sure, the article you saw just a few days ago in the New York Times about the level of debt incurred by students, particularly as they get into graduate school or professional schools like medical school and what have you. So that all of that kind of comes, you know, like you said, they're 25, 28 years old in terms of like doctors. Marriage, new kid, and there must be a tremendous burden. But what are we looking at in terms of student debt?
Well, for what we're looking at now is, you know, to go to your typical four-year public college, the average student leaves with $20,000 in debt, and many students leave with much, much more. Community college students, you know, which are supposed to be the low-cost alternative, are leaving with $8,700 in student loan debts. And then you, as you go further and further up the educational ladder, the debts get much more burdensome. You know, if you combine, if somebody goes to get a master's, they're looking at a combined student debt of about $55,000. And then law school, doctor degrees, we're looking at well over $100,000 in student loan debt.
Wow, that's a lot. You know, I was thinking there's been times, and some of it not so recently, that higher education was free. I think that there during the 19th century, maybe. In fact, I'm not into the 20th century. Some states had laws which provided for free colleges. And I know for years, wasn't it the City College in New York was
free?
Yeah, and we take
California.
And we take it for granted that that all of public education through high school is paid for by the general fund and taxes. But all of a sudden, we are paying as individuals, and sometimes very, very young individuals, 18, 19 years old, paying quite a bit for a service. And we've lost the concept that all education could be free in this society.
Right.
Yeah.
And that investing in education is pretty much a no-brainer in terms of recouping those investments. It's really the best investment we can make in terms of our future. You know, absolutely, college tuition for public universities has more than doubled in the last two decades, and that's after adjusting for inflation. You know, what's been happening is that states have been steadily decreasing their funding of higher education, so colleges are increasing tuitions as a result. There are other pressures on colleges. You know, they can play this game of raising tuition because there are more people out there who can afford it, and they've really bidded up the cost of a college degree.
Mm-hmm. And Bush's current budget, the one he's proposed, would make student loans even more expensive for those who are borrowing.
That's right. And not only do we now totally rely on student loans, you know, a generation ago, the Pell Grant, which is our primary way of helping lower-income students pay for college, you could get a grant that would cover about three-quarters of the cost of attending a public university. Today, it'll cover about a cost of a third of the cost of going to college. And the bulk of financial aid has shifted. It used to be primarily a grant-based system. Now it's primarily a debt-based system.
Hmm.
There's evidence that this system is not working. One, it's leaving young people with way too much debt when they enter the labor market. But two, and I think perhaps more disturbing, it's preventing a lot of really smart kids from getting the education they want, and could accomplish.
Now, my guest on the Peter Werbe Show is Tamara Drought. She's the director for the Economic Opportunity Program at Demos. It's a national think tank in New York, and her research and writing have appeared everywhere. The New York Times, The Wall Street Journal, USA Today. And the book is called Strapped, why America's 20 and 30-somethings can't get ahead, you can go to strappedthebook.com. That's S-T-R-A-P-P-E-D. I'll have a link on my site as well, peterwerby.com. A phenomenon that I began to see actually quite a few years ago was working with a lot of young people who I knew weren't receiving much in terms of wages, and yet they had kind of an almost new, very cool little car. They always dressed very nice. They would talk about going out to bars, and I'm thinking, how the hell did they do it? And then I realized, even though they were sometimes as old as their late 20s, they were living at home, that they did not have a housing cost, that they were still living with mom and dad. And that's a phenomena, because when I was 19 years old, I went down to Detroit's Wayne State University, got my own apartment. It was pretty cheap. It was affordable on the part-time wages that I was making. One can't do that down there now. And so is this at-home phenomena widespread?
It is, and there's been a pretty dramatic increase in the age at which people now leave home for good. It's now 24 years old, according to the census, when most young people leave home for good. And about 4 out of 10 young people will end up moving back in with their parents at least once during their 20s. You know, and it often even happens after a stint on their own. You know, they lose a job, they get divorced, and they quickly find they're you know, without a net and back in the parental nest. Rents have skyrocketed, even after adjusting for inflation in major cities across the country. And as a result, you know, young people now are spending a much higher percentage of their income on rent. And, you know, about 1 out of 3 young people spend more than 30% of their income on rent, which is what is, you know, the housing and urban development. That's pretty much the threshold for affordability, is spending no more than 30% of your income on rent. So a third of young people are already spending too much on rent, and that's up from about 1 out of 5 a generation ago. So housing is a huge issue for this generation, and trying to scrape together a down payment and move into a homeownership situation has gotten even more difficult.
Mm-hmm. Well, one of the other phenomena that we talked about briefly earlier in this interview was credit card and credit card debt. And I talk to a lot of young people. I say, how are you doing this? And they say, oh, I just put it on my credit card. And they always laugh, which I'm doing now. And I'm not sure whether it's kind of a gallows humor or the sense of the futility of it all. I mean, I've had some people say, no, I'm just going to pay $200 or $300 a month on my credit card till I die, I guess. And some of them are, of course, running up balances into the thousands, up to, and a common phrase that we've all heard, that I'm maxed out on this card, I can't use it. How much of a role does credit in the sense in plastic pay in the life of 20s and 30s, something that you write about?
Well, it plays a big role. I mean, it's nowhere near as high as student loan debts at this point anyway. But the problem is it comes at a much higher cost. Credit cards have become very expensive over the last couple decades, and particularly in the last decade in terms of 29% interest rates have become all too common. You know, you get your payment in a minute late and they jack your rate up. So what happens is young people get into credit card debt and then, like all ages, find it very difficult to get out of debt. But I think it's definitely interesting. You know, I think that young people are troubled by credit card debt, but there's also, as you said, this sense of futility and this, well, that's just the way it is. I'm going to be in credit card debt my whole life because otherwise I would never be able to see a movie, or I would never be able to do any of the things that we don't consider extravagant, but sort of, you know, the spoils of getting up and going to work every day.
Sure. Well, either we need St. Thomas Aquinas back, pardon me, I guess that was catching. That lectured against usury, this, you know, real high interest rates, or the mob. It sounds like we could get better rates from the mob. All of this has changed recently. For instance, I know that that Congress, being very sympathetic to the creditors, the large banks and what have you, have both allowed higher interest rates. And we're in a period now where I think that the minimum payment is able to be doubled. And plus, bankruptcy now is not an option to the extent that it previously was.
Yeah, well, people are, that's exactly right. People are in the grips of a of an industry that has been basically given a free pass on and been allowed to do whatever they want in terms of pricing of their product. It used to be that we had what was called usury laws. Unfortunately, we've deregulated this industry through a series of Supreme Court decisions. And if you notice, sort of when those solicitations come in the mail, they're coming from Delaware, they're coming from South Dakota, because those states don't have any limits on the amount of interest rates that can be charged. And the companies are located there because they can just export that interest rate to the rest of the nation. So as a result, you know, credit card companies have become much more aggressive and much more deceptive. You know, they offer these 0% teaser rates, but then, you know, you get your payment in a minute past the due date and they'll quickly jack it up to 29%. You're late with another creditor, but not with them. They'll go ahead and increase your rate anyway. And the one thing I can't believe they get away with is they actually are able to increase your rate and apply it to everything, to the existing balance on the card.
Yeah, they've got friends in high places.
Right, right.
You know, Tamara, before we run out of time, as I said at the beginning, identifying problems these days is pretty easy, although you've done a marvelous job in accumulating them here in your book, Strapped. What the really hard part is talking about solutions. So tell us quickly, if you would, about Demos, the think tank you work for, and what, for instance, some sample solutions to some of the problems that we've spoken about.
Sure. Well, Demos is a nonpartisan think tank. We do research and advocacy, so it's actually more of a think and do tank in New York City that's fighting to expand the middle class, you know, create more economic justice in this country, and expand political participation, which is interesting because I think that's really at the heart of changing this system and changing courses. You know, young people have got to get involved politically, and I make a real case to them in this book. You know, previous generations got that the personal was political, and that's a notion that has been lost in a generation. We tend to individualize our problems, and that's no accident. We've been brought up to think of everything as being our own fault, and that government's the problem, not the solution. So young people really need to realize that what's happening to them is part of a much larger shift in ideology and political priorities. That being said, we've got to end the debt for diploma system. We know that when you provide generous grant aid and keep tuitions low, that we increase access to college, and we give young people a real chance to actually get ahead when they hit the labor market. We need to make sure that we need to increase the quality of jobs in this country. You know, this is a huge issue for Detroit. We need to do a whole range of things to make sure that we are making it possible for people who aren't on a four-year path to get in a four-year college path to get into the middle class. And finally, we need to address the health care issue, which surprisingly is a really big issue for young people. They actually have the highest rate of uninsurance in this country.
Right, that would make sense, given that they're in lower-paying jobs that often don't even provide it and certainly don't have the income to provide it themselves. But right now, we don't have any money. We as a nation, we as the taxpayers, it's all going for other purposes. There'd have to be a massive redirection of our national wealth.
That's absolutely right, and it's an uphill battle. But it's got to start with saying no to making these tax cuts permanent. Which has really contributed to the deficit. So the first thing we got to do is get back on a course of financial common sense. And once we do that, you know, we really need to keep pushing for a change in our priorities and for more investments in the public structures that make this country a better place to live.
Well, I would suggest two books, surprisingly. One, of course, authored by my guest, Tamara Drought. It's called Strapped, S-T-R-A-P-P-E-D, and you can go to strappedthebook.com. The subtitle is the important part of it. Why America's 20 and 30-somethings can't get ahead, and best of all, as we've been talking for the last few minutes, solutions that Demos, the organization, the think tank, is providing. But also, I have another book in my hand that I would suggest as well, and it's a Demos book also. Inequality Matters, The Growing Economic Divide in America and Its Poisonous Consequences. It fits right into this one as well. Tamara Drought, thanks for joining me on the Peter Werbe Show.
Thanks for having me.
This is WRIF.com.
Right on, you rock.
You're at 1 minute on the Riff.
Buy it the next at WRIF.com. Just 99 cents gets you the tunes you love for your very own. Download it right to your PC.
Your Riff Rock. Online at WRIF.com.
I like it.
Everything that rocks. Rocks.
You're listening to WRIF.com.
With the hip, high, and get you higher than a tree top. You wanna roll with
way past the norm, still misbehaving, finger in the air and the flag still waving. Young clone, don't catch the bomb, cause I got this stone like Betsy Ross. You can floss the front, you can pawn the tease, but you can't with rhymes like these. Bumping like a drum kit with riffs that split picks, bumping for the kids who twist spliffs and sip fists. I got the gift, I'm about to unwrap.